to the Floor, 8 weeks at number one from Chevelle. It's going to take a great song to kick them off the top.
Go to thesideshowcountdown.com to get caught up on the entire chart. Download the iHeartRadio app to listen to us no matter where you are.
I'm Nikki Sixx.
I'm Carrie Cato.
And we will see you next weekend.
The Sideshow is now over. Go ahead. Stick a golden fork in it. We're done.
101 WRIF and Sobe Light Water with Coconut Water want you to have the ultimate man card adventure with the hottest ticket of the year. Listen to win a Sobe prize pack, including your own WRIF man card and a copy of the Sports Illustrated Swimsuit Edition. One lucky riff winner and a guest will be jetting off to Las Vegas in style February 14th through the 16th for the exclusive invitational new launch party for the 2012 Sports Illustrated Swimsuit Issue. Plus $200 spending cash.
You must be 21 or older to qualify.
Listen and win from new Sobe Life Water with Coconut Water. Flavor with benefits. And 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Now.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. We got a few shockers for you today.
Oh, boy, big stuff.
Yeah, Jolene and I are going to church tomorrow.
We are going to church,
people. And I know that's going to blow a lot of minds for a lot of you longtime listeners who think we're irreligious, blasphemous, and all that. But welcome to Night Call. I'm Peter Werby. Jolene Jordan is here with me. And our phone number to call in, because this is a phone-in talk show, 313-298-WRIF.
It's 313-298-9743.
I'm also going to ask for a volunteer, for somebody that can do some math for me.
Well, we need that badly.
We do, because I'm math challenged. Hey, we have a Facebook page, which we'd like you to like. And
we would.
It is facebook.com/nightcall. How can we get this simple one? And some of them are these long, drawn-out ones.
We got lucky?
Okay. Yeah, yeah. If you'd like to email us, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. That's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. We will have a podcast up at noon tomorrow, Martin Luther King holiday. I'm surprised how many people are working. I mean, it's a legal federal holiday.
Yeah,
right?
I know. It's. I don't know. That bothers me.
We're off. Or I am. Are you working?
No, I'm not working.
All right.
No.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. That's right. But, you know, we've had a little trouble with the podcast, and none of us can figure it out. There's like a 16-minute big space before you actually get to it.
Yeah, before any audio begins. So that's the latest, greatest puzzle in the podcast.
All right. But before, and this may shock you as well, but before we begin, I'd like to thank Jesus.
Peter,
I would like to thank Jesus.
You're thanking Jesus.
I would. I'd like to thank Jesus for kicking Tim Tebow's ass and putting Tom Brady and the New England Patriots on the planet.
Yes, and I beating, heard that happened.
And beating the Broncos 45-10.
My gosh. Yeah. Well, where was Jesus?
Well, what does this say? I don't understand this. What does this mean? If everybody thinks, no, let's be a little precise here. If there are a lot of people, let me see, I actually have the figures here. 43% of the people that believe that divine intervention is responsible for Tebow's success, compared to 42% of the people surveyed who think that God has nothing to do with Tebow winning.
Talk about a mind blower.
Yeah. So what does that mean if somehow Jesus was intervening in the fourth quarter?
Because I know there's more than one quarterback in the NFL who believes in Jesus.
Yeah, that's what's always so crazy. But what about sports in other countries? What about Manchester United? I mean, there's probably some Christians on that team. I mean, are they getting helped? What about like cricket players in India and Pakistan? Christians, because they do have Christians there. I mean, this is so absurd, people, that I mean.
And all the attention. I like one of the headlines in the New York Times from the other day. He's a quarterback. He's a winner. He's a TV draw. He's a verb.
Wow. But what possible interest could Jesus have in football?
I think that's a very good question.
I just don't get it. Maybe one of you could tell me, but I suspect there is not anybody who thinks that somehow Jesus is connected with Tim Tebow and football that would actually have the nerve to call 313-298-WRIF and have
and
us
explain it?
And explain it to us. I promise, if we start to laugh, we'll turn our microphone off. I won't argue with you.
I won't let you speak.
You're a moron.
We won't hang up.
We won't hang up on you. But why would Jesus? I mean,
you know, every time we throw something out like that and promise not to.
Nobody calls. Yeah.
But, you know, there's also tonight the Golden Globes happened, so there was Jesus was responsible for a lot of those awards.
Oh, no, and, no, they didn't. On that, they actually thanked Jesus?
I believe so, and we'll find out long about after midnight, because my friend, who's a local actor, writer, producer, is watching, and I asked him to watch with our show in mind, and he's going to give us a couple of the highlights.
You know what's really terrible? The majority of actors, I mean, it's true with rock bands as well. I used to host the Motor City Riffs, which we played local music.
Yeah.
And oftentimes the bands would say to me, what do we have to do to be a hit? What's wrong with our, they'd ask me, what's wrong with our music? And very frequently, in terms of quality and, I don't know, creativity mm-hmm. and all the rest of it.
Talent,
yeah. Good singers, terrific production. Didn't sound any different than what we're playing that's real popular music on the air, on WRIF. And I have no idea. And so what does it mean?
There's a little bit of luck involved.
And
there's knowing people involved.
Well, I know. There are all these things, but what in the world could Jesus have to do with it? So Jesus said, well, I'm going to pick that person. You know?
Just that one.
Yeah.
The rest of you suckers, sorry.
Yeah. What do they say? You know, he knows when you are sleeping.
That's Santa Claus.
Oh, all right.
Well, you did not just go there. Oh, you're
right.
Funny.
And everybody's T-bowing now, which is this deal where you get down on one knee and piously you put your elbow on your knee.
I finally had to look it up because, you know, I don't watch television, Peter. You know how proud I am to say that these days. I definitely don't watch sports. If I do, it's only the Detroit Lions or the Red Wings or the Tigers. That's it.
There you go. When a wedding party T-bows in Las Vegas, or a couple T-bows on Abbey Road in London, or two scuba divers T-bow underwater in Belize, it can be hard to tell whether they are celebrating or mocking him for his virtuous ways. This is by a Dan Barry column. What exactly is it about Tim Tebow that so fascinates and provokes us? Why do some people project onto him the best of this country? Humility, tenacity, plain old decency?
Uh-huh.
Where's this in our country? Humility, plain old decency. That is gone.
That's rare.
Tenacity, that's true. But the worst, sanctimonious, overexposure, political intolerance.
Oh.
That sounds like the Republican primary.
Yeah, there's South Carolina. Can you say South Carolina?
Sanctimonious, overexposure. Do you know, and you came back from Iowa last week, that the airwaves, that's all they have. They don't have any Kentucky Fried Chicken ads. All they have are ads
political ads. Bombardment.
Yeah. Let's see. 43% of people believe God helps Tebow win.
Yeah. And can I tell you something funny?
Go ahead.
I know you hate when people say that. Can I ask you a question? Can I just say it, right?
Yeah.
Anyhow, I have a friend who lives in Florida, and I highly doubt he's listening. I don't think he'd be mad if I told this story, but he got a dog, a new puppy. And he named it Tebow, and I didn't even know who that was.
Okay.
And now that I know who this individual is, it makes me laugh so hard because my friend's Jewish.
Well, that's bizarre.
I know.
Well, what about this? They broke it down in terms of these 43% of the people who think that Jesus or God intervenes in Tebow winning. This is, before last night. So I wonder what all these people know. Well, what do they say now? I mean, I have no idea. But it shows that 52% of people in the 18 to 29-year-old age range believe that supernatural powers help Tebow.
Yeah, and that's 18 to 29. That was actually surprising to me because we talk so much and hear so much about the fact that the younger generation is not as religious
they're not.
You know, that the religion is becoming less interesting or intriguing to the younger folk.
How about this? Hispanic fans also feel that a holy power is helping the Broncos quarterback, as 81% of those polled believe God is behind Tebow.
Well, that's not surprising to me because, you know, I spent quite a bit of time in Mexico, and there are images of the Mother Mary and Jesus on everything and everywhere, you yeah. know, so that it's a very religious country. Yeah.
But what in the world can they make of this now? He got pasted. He got pasted by this high-living, you know, Tom Brady's married to a supermodel.
Oh, and, Gisele Bündchen. Yeah.
And Tim Tebow says he's a virgin and all this.
Oh, I missed. Wait, how I missed that little, yeah, little bitch. Oh,
60% of African Americans believe that Tim Tebow is helped by Jesus. This is before the big loss. 38% among white people. This is interesting. This is odd when white people actually have a clue.
Because there were fewer percentage
Of them. Right.
Yeah, right.
Among party affiliations, of course, 54% of Republicans believe God is helping Tebow. Well, only 48% of Democrats think...
Well, geez, that's only 4% or 6%, and that is scary. Well,
but
that scares me.
Well, what's really bringing it up is Hispanic and African Americans.
Right, you're
that
right.
That are usually Democrats.
Uh-huh. In the main, except for Herman McCain, did you hear he's taking a bus tour?
No.
He's pulling a Sarah Palin and taking a bus out, and he's going to, because he wants to keep 999 alive.
999, I believe in that.
He wants to keep it alive.
Except I spell it N-E-I-N, N-E-I-N, you know, like the German, no. If God didn't help Tebow, says Michael Boykin, he wouldn't even exist. What does this mean? The problem is not that God helps Tebow, but how does God manifest that help? The assumption is that it's God's will that Tebow be a successful football player. That is nothing more than triumphalism. Triumph? It's easy for you to say. Sometimes, I can't. This is nuts.
It's just throw it over the ear.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, there.
Out of here.
Yeah.
What's this, happened to this country?
Any comment on Tim Tebow? Or did you believe? Is there any? Well, let me see. I haven't even looked at our. Why doesn't my little moose
you
work? Did,
are you
there.
Posing a question,
yeah.
Peter?
Yeah, the question was somebody that has the belief that Tim Tebow actually was helped by Jesus.
Had the assistance of Jesus.
How in the world would you think that? I mean, it seems so, I hate to say it, idiotic.
Does he take his little fingers and go?
Throw it, Tom. Throw it now. You know, there was some thought, you know, he threw this long, Tebow threw this long pass in the first seconds of overtime with Pittsburgh Steelers.
Yeah.
And there was some thought that the team didn't have the required
Jesus?
seven men at the scrimmage line, and that it wasn't even illegal. But I guess maybe Jesus kind of
sure.
covered the eyes of the referees or something like that.
Oh, well, if nothing else, it's been great entertainment.
Tim Tebow endorses jockeys.
Jockeys?
Jockey shorts.
Why? What? Oh, as in the brand name?
Yeah.
Or he's saying briefs over boxers.
Yeah, no. He.
And he's definitely not a commando kind of guy.
All right.
I guarantee you that.
Here's the help I need. I just, oh, great. This is just what I wanted to see on my screen. Welcome to Windows Media Player. Get out of here.
How
do I get rid of it? Okay, there you go.
Okay.
All right. Up. We do have a Tim Tebow caller.
Good.
But only one. Why is that? All right. There, Forbes, the magazine, lists the top richest 400 people in America.
Yes.
And we're talking about a country now that upwards of 50% of our population is either poor or near poor.
Right.
That a third of the middle class has dropped down into that category.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in how much money these fat cats are controlling. So what I need is someone that would be willing, or a number of you, would be willing
definitely
to volunteer.
Don't ask your producer.
No.
She can't do very
just,
well, good math.
Just
know?
go to Google and just do Forbes 400 richest Americans, not the world, just the 400 richest Americans.
Important.
And total up their wealth. I mean, what do they get? I know the top 10, which includes the Koch brothers and the Walton kids and, of course, Gates and Buffett and Larry Ellison.
And that's about it.
Yeah. And depending, Bloomberg is sometimes in there. Sometimes, yeah, the mayor of New York, like $18 billion. But this could have been for 2010.
Mm-hmm.
In any event, just give me the figure. The 400 richest in the world, they're sitting on $1.5 trillion.
You just want the top 10.
Yeah.
Add it up.
Yeah. One of the things is the 40 states combined have a debt of $125 billion. And the top 10 richest Americans have a combined total, this is in 2010, of $270 billion. So, in other words, these fat cats could just roll off this money to the states,
out of their
pay
pocket.
Off all the debts, and guess what? They'd still be billionaires.
Absolutely.
Some of them.
Just be a little dent.
Yeah, they would.
A little dent.
They would. I mean, maybe one of the poorer guys, like Michael Bloomberg, mayor of New York, he may be down around $2 or $3 billion or something like that. The Waltons, the richest family in America, and they're all, what's their goal?
Their combined wealth, just the kids, that of, 30%? Of the entire population, or is it
something?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's it ain't right. But you know what it's about, right? It's about envy.
It is.
That's what ordinary American Mitt, or well, let's call him by his real name, Willis Romney says. Oh, Willis Mitt Romney. He says that the question isn't about the increasing separation of wealth, that it's not about the rich getting richer and the middle class and the poor and the working class getting poorer. It's about envy. Right?
Yes, yes.
That's what it's all about.
Yeah,
it's not real.
Uh-huh.
He said, let's see, in his New Hampshire victory speech on Tuesday, Romney lambasted his Republican opponents, who have raised some real issues about his role at the private equity firm Bain Capital, for following the lead of President Obama, whom he described as a leader who divides us, quote, with the bitter politics of envy.
This guy, unreal. I mean, it's like they're just crawling, you know, with their fingernails up a chalkboard, trying to get to the top. It's disgusting. He's under a lot of hot water for this.
Yeah, Santorum. I looked that up. Santorum.
Google.
Adults only. Google it. Adults only, please.
We can't resist.
No, we can't resist. He said there is no such thing as classes in America.
I mean, what planet is he on?
He's on
planet politician.
Rich guy's planet that's trying to fool the classes below him.
That's right. And that is criminal in itself.
Well, here's what Romney said the next day, defending his statement. He rejected the notion that there were questions about Wall Street behavior, saying the whole discussion was about class warfare. He even went so far as to suggest that such talk shouldn't even be openly entertained. When the interviewer asked, are there no fair questions about the distribution of wealth without it being seen as envy? Romney responded, I think it's fine to talk about these things in quiet rooms.
I mean, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, because we don't want the masses to know. We don't want this to leak out to the mainstream media so the people actually know what's really going on.
He's a little behind the curve. The Pew Research Center found that about two-thirds of Americans now perceive a strong conflict between rich and poor in this country, and that's up 19% from 2009. And by the way, the majority of Republicans, the majority of teabaggers also see that as an issue. And as we said, one-third of the middle class has now suffered downward mobility.
I mean, you can say that again, and I think that's putting it nicely.
I forgot what I said, or I'd say it again.
We got an email from AE real quickly. He said, Peter, religion is funny. Religion is funny. Fundamentalist Christians have traditionally hated Catholics, Mormons, and black people. This weekend, a clavern of fundamentalist leaders gathered in Texas and designated Rick Santorum their favorite Republican candidate for president. Their ultimate goal is to remove a black man from the White House. They don't want to support a Mormon to do that unless they have no other choice. They would rather support a Catholic. And he said, or he or she, not sure what it is. I guess it's all a matter of which they hate the most. Ooh.
Oh, yeah. Well, we were talking last week. David Brooks, a conservative columnist in the New York Times, said the Republican Party is the party of the white working class. It's the largest bloc in the electorate. They overwhelmingly favor Republicans. And here you get an idea why. In Sumter, South Carolina today, amid shaking hands and signing campaign posters, Mitt Romney did something he has never done before on the rope line. He took out his wallet and handed a wad of cash to a woman waiting to shake his hand.
This is so pathetic. I just read this before I came to the show tonight, Peter, and I thought, you did not. You did not take out a wad of cash.
Wait. Do you think this is fabricated?
I think it's disgusting, whatever it is.
Oh, I mean, I miss the inflection in your voice.
So. Oh, and meanwhile, in his head, he's privatizing Social Security and taking away all of the protections and health care for the elderly, taking money out of people's pockets on a governmental, federal level. But he's sitting there making the world think that I'm going to help you. I'm going to help you, lady.
Well, here's what happened. The woman, 55-year-old Ruth Williams, says she's been following the Romney campaign since he arrived in the state. When she said she received a message from God to track him down.
What did we used to call it?
Stalker!
Yeah, no doubt. Which is a federal offense.
Yeah. So, she says, I was on the highway praying and said, God, you just show me to get my lights on. And I pulled up to a sign and his bus was there. And then God said, follow that bus.
The
bus to the airport. Why is this any more loony?
And where was Secret Service?
Than the people that think Tim Tebow is aided by Jesus.
Well, you know, it isn't any more loony. You're right. It's just equal loony.
According to William, she followed the campaign bus to the airport the same day. Da, 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 da. He was kind to me, and he made Governor Nikki Haley of South Carolina. And he said that he confirmed that he gave her $150. I mean, this guy's a multimillionaire, and he should. You know, I was looking.
Well, he was probably low on cash, you know?
Yeah.
He didn't have it all in his, you know, he spent a lot of his pocket cash that day.
I was I was looking for something about Romney, and I sort of missed it.
Those were the biggest highlights of the week for him, other than winning.
Well, here's
East Coast.
Oh, yeah. We were talking about that. David Brooks said that the Republican Party was the party of the white working class. Romney says, and again, maybe there's some Republicans listening, and if you have the wherewithal to call 313-298-WRIF, tell me what this statement means. This is Willard Romney. You know, the president puts his faith in government. We put our faith in the American people. So what does that mean? I don't know.
I don't either.
Yeah, it's another one of those.
You hear my silence.
Yeah, it's another one of those kind of
empty phrases.
Empty slogans, yeah. He says, President Obama wants to put free enterprise on trials, and that I will offer the American ideals of economic freedom a clear and unapologetic defense. Whatever. And I was looking, though. Oh, yeah. Democrats have made inroads in recent elections among affluent, well-educated voters. I mean, in other words, some richy rich kids are actually getting a conscience. Mr. Obama's 2008 campaign captured the majority of voters earning more than $200,000. But get this. In 2008, Senator John McCain got more votes among whites earning less than $50,000 than Obama.
So sad.
I mean, what is with any of you who did that? I mean, did you really want a continuation of the Bush administration?
Right. And did your life get any better? I mean, during the Bush years, let's talk about that.
Did you really want to continue more wars? Did you really want to give more tax breaks to the wealthy? Did you really want to have less mine safety and more arsenic in your water and everything else, every giveaway to the rich? Did you really want, what was the name of that energy company? Began with an E?
Enron.
Did you really want Enron in the room when they were writing energy policy and all that? I mean,
Shudder.
How dumb are you? I mean, and that's not me. I know.
You're being kind of mean.
I am kind of mean, and you probably should just say should be argumentation. That's what they call ad hominem arguments. You attack the man, not the argument.
Yeah, we get a little heat for that once in a while.
It's incomprehensible to me. I've seen that. I sometimes walk through a working class, a middle class, and an upper middle class.
On the same walk.
On the same walk.
I picture your route in my mind.
Okay? All three of these suburbs went Democratic, but the ones that went the most was the most upscale.
That was amazing to me.
And I'm thinking, how in the world could these people in these very small 800 square foot houses, not being critical
bungalows.
Of the houses, little bungalows.
That's what I live in.
Vote for these rich guys who have the interests only of the ultra wealthy, the 1%, who don't care about you at all.
At all. I mean, really, just turn the Fox News off. Turn it off because really all it is doing is hurting you and those around you.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes people will say to me, look, you're a Democrat. Well, first off,
we're not.
We're not. But secondly, if you wanted to make an argument that the Democrats and the Republicans were exactly the same, it really ceased to be it. I mean, I said last week that Obama and the Democrats are better than a stick in the eye, but the Republicans are a stick in the eye. So it's better that the stick misses. But if you said to me, both parties disgust me, stay home then. I mean, because don't vote for either of them. But don't vote for a party that is intent on cutting your throat. In fact, I've got too many things in my hands here.
It's out of control over there.
It is. I've got, there is this, not in this one. Oh, man, this.
While you're looking for it, let me say, Peter and I will be downtown.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I forgot all about that. We're going to church tomorrow.
Yeah, we're going to church tomorrow. And yeah. But don't. Don't be afraid. We haven't converted, but we are going to the Central United Methodist Church starting at noon. There is a Martin Luther King march, rally, and cultural event as well. So we'll be meeting there noon. I think we're marching first.
And it's sort of both.
Then there's a rally, and then the event is after we get back to church. And just an announcement from Michael, who wrote to us from the organization. Free parking is available all day in the lots east of Woodward and Elizabeth on the north and south sides of Elizabeth. So, and if you want any information, go to mlkdetroit.org.
Or Peter Werbe.
.com.
W-E-R-B-E. Yeah, all right. Here's what I was looking for. The Republican primary in South Carolina will probably be a study in the balance between social conservatism and the economy. Although issues of black and white relations remain an undercurrent in the state where the Civil War began. Remember, these were the biggest traitors in American history. The South was responsible for the deaths of more Americans being killed because of the Civil War they initiated to maintain slavery than all the dead in the rest of the wars the United States has fought.
And,
including shooting my great-granddaddy.
Your grandpappy!
Great-granddaddy.
Who was?
Red Bigham. He was from the Michigan Summer Other Volunteers.
I love that story.
Yeah, so, the Johnny Reb, I can't even say it. Yeah, he's buried out in, why can't I ever remember the name of that cemetery, out on
Fort Street. And someone always calls and reminds you.
Yeah, they have the GAR, the Grand Army of the Republic, burial ground. He's buried out there. I've gone out there a few times. But let's see. Scott Buchanan, executive director of the Citadel Symposium on Southern Politics, say blacks, whether they are rich or poor or middle class, largely vote Democrat. Poor whites tend to vote Republican. You are stupid.
Don't do it.
How can you be that dumb?
Shooting yourself in the foot.
All right. Here.
That's putting it lightly.
Pamela Barksdale, an African-American and an unemployed former BMW worker who lives in a part of northeast South Carolina that was devastated by the collapse of the textile industry, said neither she nor any other black person she knew would ever vote for a Republican. She said, "Do you think I want to choke myself to death?"
Yeah.
And
that's
she
like dating a Republican.
And
ew!
She is sort of speaking, I would say, for all middle income and below. In fact, the 99%. I mean, it shouldn't even be ascribed to race. It should be ascribed to somebody that knows what their own interests are, what the interests of their family and their community in this country are all about. You vote Republican, do you think I want to choke myself to death? And you say, well, we're going to vote for the Democrats. Well, you know, I probably will, just to stop Willard Romney and his rats from getting in. Remember, there was a movie called Willard. It was about he could command all these rats.
Yeah.
But not with any great enthusiasm, that's for sure. But that's not what we want to do, It's not what we can do to change this country, voting for either Barack Obama or Willard. I mean, if those are the choices, we are screwed. We've got to make history. We've got to start taking up what the Occupy movement has put forth. And that's happening. The Occupy movement, by the way, is part of this Martin Luther King Observance Day. And the big demonstration, though, may turn out to be at the home of Governor Rick Snyder.
Yeah.
So they're really going to have a big demonstration out there that all these ministers and Congressman John Conyers, because what they're aiming this at is what Representative Conyers calls Public Act 4, a sick law that unfairly targets urban cities. That is about having these financial managers. So, and this is So undemocratic.
And now he's
so
going after Highland Park with that.
Yeah, well, these cities are really stressed. They have financial emergencies. But why in the world, well, it's occurred to you a couple of things, that it's, that the cities that get taken over are A, poor, B, urban, C, predominantly African American, and where am I, ABC, D, they are heavily unionized. And that's what they want to do. They want to break all
the
unions. They want to destroy the political party, power of the urban Democratic Party. So this is all a scam. But why, if we live in a country that is the wealthiest country in the world, why are there cities that are so poor? And why are there cities that are so filled with so many, where so many poor people are parked?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what should be addressed. And is it somehow mismanagement? Did somehow Detroit mismanage? I mean, even with Kwame Kilpatrick in his corrupt old ways, it wasn't that like bankrupted the city. I mean, that jerk could have been a decent mayor if it wasn't so arrogant and so self-consumed
and greedy
and what have you.
He's pretty corrupt.
He was actually thought well of when he started.
Before, he really was.
I mean,
yeah, he really was.
But other cities, Highland Park and Pontiac and what was the other one out on the west side of the state?
Grand Haven?
No, but
not Grand Haven, but Benton Harbor?
Benton Harbor, yeah. That was the first one, I think. So what we got to ask ourselves is, why is this happening to cities like this?
Yeah, and these guys, you know, these Republicans who, especially you hear it from these candidates, who just can't help themselves with their racial vomitous, you know, verbalizing.
It just kind of comes out. What is that called?
It's called
Tourette's.
Political Tourette's.
Political Tourette's.
Little political racist Tourette's.
Yeah.
And they'll say things like, well, we don't want to, you know, help these people be lazy. They need to go out and actually do something for themselves. I mean, these sons of a bitches.
Do you want to tell us how you really feel about these people?
I could. But I'm holding back to you.
All right. We've got a number of people waiting. Apologies to those that haven't got a chance to talk yet. But Mike and Debbie, who'd rather not say where she's from.
That's
it's okay.
Fine.
It's all right, Debbie.
You don't have to
stay on the line.
Yeah.
But we're talking about Tim Tebow. How do you account for the fact that almost half the people thought Jesus was pulling the strings and fixing the game? Is that fair?
Yeah, isn't that illegal?
We're just out there playing ball the best we can. These guys got Jesus on their side. That does not seem fair.
Oh.
But I want to talk, too, and this is no laughing matter, these Marines that pissed on the dead bodies of these so-called Taliban. We don't know who they were for sure.
And so someone, who was it, one of these Republicans said that we should just let it go.
Let it go, yeah. Well, we'll talk about that when we come back. And Tim Tebow and, I don't know. Do we even want to talk about the Republican primary?
You're listening to Nightfall with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
So we're back, and we got some more music coming up in just a second. But first, this news just came in. Right now, the government and private banks are liquidating houses. Now, these are homes that have been foreclosed, confiscated, or repossessed, and they may be sold for little or no money down. Here's a toll-free number so you can find out how to get a free list of these foreclosures. 1-800-923-1051. 1-800-923-1051. It says here, every house must be sold. The government and banks are very motivated to sell these homes, and they may be sold for little or no money down. Looks like there's currently over 400,000 foreclosures in the database being liquidated now. Homes may be sold for little or no money down. Ask how you can get a free list of these foreclosures by calling Hot Props at 1-800-923-1051. Call 1-800-923-1051. That's 1-800-923-1051.
Julie, you're listening to Night Call, the
Lift's award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
313-298-WRIF is our phone number, and numerically...
And that is 313-298-9743. Now, Peter, earlier you had asked the question, we were talking about the top net worth of first the 400 and then the top 10 in the United States, according to Forbes. And my very good friend Jordan let us know that the top 10's net worth is $291 billion.
Okay.
Okay.
We need the top 400. That's a work.
Now here's more math for you, Jordan. To the top 400. I'll talk to you about 5 in the morning.
Yeah. So, but by the way, in 2010, it was $270 billion. So it's gone up. So this is what I'm talking about, folks. I mean, this is a shift of wealth. I mean, there's X amount of wealth in any given society. And the whole question, and it's a political question, is how is it distributed? I mean, it could be dog eat dog, the way it was in the 19th century, or kind of like it is now.
Yeah.
Or it could be split completely even and call it communism, or it could be something in between. So people, you know, meritocracy, you know, people get rewarded more. But this is out of control. So if they're getting $20 billion more, that means somebody else is getting $20 million less. Figure that. By the way, my great-great-grandfather, who fought in the Civil War with the Michigan Volunteers, I don't know the number, is buried. Thanks, George, who wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com, is buried in Woodmere Cemetery.
Is that Red?
Red Bigham is out there. You can find him. You can find him. And,
I love that.
Yeah, and there's a lot of interesting grave sites out there, including the bodies of the four people killed by the Dearborn police during, I think it was 1932, Dearborn Hunger March, is that a few thousand people marched from Detroit. They were going to go to the Rouge plant to demand that it be opened and jobs be given to them. Mm-hmm. And the what was called the Ford Service Department, which was really just this armed goon squad that tried to stop unionization. And the Dearborn police opened fire on these people, wounded a whole bunch, killed four people. Three whites and one African-American, and at the time they wouldn't let the African-American be buried in a, quote, white cemetery. But they're there now. And it's a pretty it takes some doing to find these. They're just little in-ground little stones, you know. So actually, myself and some other people have been talking about trying to create a proper memorial to these.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah. By the way, I just wanted to say one thing, and I know a lot of you are holding on, and we've just been yakking it up, but I'll be right to you. I quoted Pamela Barksdale, this African-American who said that she would never vote for a Republican. She said, "Do you think I want to choke myself to death?" And I said, that's really true, should be true, of any middle class or working class or and certainly any poor people. But we find out that whites apparently making under 50 grand are voting for the Republicans. Mm. Now, here's what went and you can tell that here's proof that the Republican Party is racist. The Democratic Party during the 19th and the first half of the 20th century was what kept segregation and racism in place in the South. It was what they called the Solid South. Segregation was the norm. It was kept there in this most corrupt and venal manner. Even some of these liberal senators between 1900 and 1960, they still would vote for segregation. They would never vote for civil rights or anything like that. When suddenly the Democrats, and I mean, talk about having some conscience and having some values, embrace civil rights under a guy who was elected as a segregationist, President Johnson, as a senator, he was. And you always had to have like a Southern, either, you know, Southern vice president. Is that then the whites fled the Democratic Party to the Republican Party. And it became it became the solid Republican South in 1980 when Ronald Reagan went to, I'm forgetting my history, Meshuggah, one of the county in which these white racist terrorists killed those three civil rights workers.
Mississippi.
Yeah, Meshuggah County, something like that. And I can't remember the town. He went to the town in which they were killed. And if this was not an annunciation, an announcement that we are now the party of racism, of white racists who cannot see their own financial, social, ethical, and to some people religious interests, instead are blinded by race. I mean, there's all your proof.
You know, we were talking about Ford. I just want to throw out a musical suggestion. There's a song called Henry Ford Was a Fascist by David Rovics. So go to davidrovics.com and you can download all of his music for free. He's our friend, but I also work for him, so I support him all the way.
Hitler was a big fan of Henry Ford.
Of Grandpa Ford.
Yeah,
and he had a picture of him in his bunker.
At the end, yeah. Henry Ford was awarded the Iron Cross in Detroit in 1938 by a representative of the German government.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Very sweet. All right, sweetheart.
All right, here's somebody who's calling from very far away, so let's get them. Here's Mike from Florida, formerly from Birmingham. Hey, Mike, you're on the air. Welcome.
How you doing, Peter? How you doing, Jolene?
We're good.
Mike. Welcome.
Yeah, they've been talking in the news here in Florida about, some places in Florida are trying to push prayer in public schools, like trying to get laws passed that would allow prayer in public schools, and some schools are actually, you know, allowing kids to recite prayers. Like I guess they don't actually allow the teachers to conduct the prayers, but the students themselves are conducting the prayers.
There's even some prohibition on that. It's kind of complicated. I mean, Supreme Court in its wisdom said that prayer has no place in public schools.
Right.
And one of the things that these religious conservatives say is that, that morality went to hell. Well, and they say it's it. And they kicked God out of the schools in the early 1960s. And look at the 60s. Well, all the activists in the 60s went to schools in the 50s when they allowed prayer.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah, I guess one girl whose family was atheist, whose father was an atheist, she wound up going to the ACLU and she filed a lawsuit against the school for having mandatory prayer at public prayer.
Yeah,
this is in Florida, and she won the case, but. Other states, I think some red states are trying to actually have laws passed that would you know. Allow.
Well, they might, because they're always trying to get laws that contravene.
Well, they're going to have to allow every kind of prayer, and that the prayer will last about an hour. Then they're going to have to start school at 5 a.m.
because get the other religions.
Yeah.
Well, but the Supreme Court has held that laws like that are unconstitutional. So that's it. All right, Mike, thanks for calling. We're here at home for you. You're in Florida. It's a little cold up here.
Yes.
All right, thanks. Thanks a lot.
Enjoy your weather.
Appreciate it. Here is Debbie. Debbie is somewhere, but hi,
right
Debbie.
Here.
Yeah, you're right there. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi. You know, I listen to you guys faithfully every single week.
We appreciate that.
And I really enjoy your show. I am Christian. However, I'm a very liberal Christian.
You're a good Christian. You're the definition of a real, live, good Christian, right?
Yeah.
All the Christians I know are liberals, by the way.
Oh, well, good, good. Yeah. Anyway, basically what I wanted to say is I don't think, you know, I think the only thing God has to do, or Jesus has to do with people in sports or music or anything like that that are saying thank you to God or whatever, are people that, you know, maybe it's the confidence that the Lord gives them. I don't know. But I don't think it has anything other than that to do with it.
I agree. I mean, there's
that's
a lot
a
of
good point, yeah.
There's a lot of confident atheists, too. So I don't know. How do they get ahead?
Exactly.
The reason why I didn't say where I'm from is I'm from a small town, so, you know, things get around. So.
Your secret is safe with us,
Debbie.
Yeah,
we won't tell anyone, Debbie.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call.
Peter, our buddy Mike Kitchen. Hey, Mike. How's
it
going? Mike. Yeah. Who was a one-time sponsor of the show, which with his former show store, the Waking Up Store. He said if Tebow were a Muslim, I think those poll numbers suggesting whether Tebow was getting help from Muhammad would be much different. Thank you, Mike.
That is good. That is good.
You're the best.
Well, there's a situation. This video has now gone viral in Afghanistan where these Marines were shown pissing on the dead bodies of these dead.
Oh.
They said to be Taliban. Of course, they have no way of knowing. They've now identified them. And so you hear these conservatives are saying they should be put on KP duty and then returned to duty.
And that's it. That's all.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Rick Perry says Marines in video are, quote, kids, not criminals. Well, we don't know how old they are. And he urges no criminal charges over Marines video. Well, there's a problem with all of that and looking at it like that. But let's go to Dave and Clinton and see what he has to say. Hi, you're on the air. Welcome. What do you think?
How's it going, Peter?
Good.
You know, these guys, they go out there in the battlefield. They put their life on the line. And, you know, it's all right for the Taliban to drag around soldiers behind their cars, chop off their head, or torture them.
We don't think that.
Well, I know it's despicable that they did piss on them.
Yeah.
But you know what? These guys are putting their ass on the line for our freedom.
So they can piss on dead bodies? And where do these two things go together at all?
Well, wait a minute. Here is the problem, Dave. It is against international law. It is against U.S. law, and it's against the Marine Corps. It's against the what do you call it? I can't even think of it. The code, you know, the United. Why can't I think of this? Anyway, it's against the law. I mean, maybe you could understand they're mad, their buddies got killed. You can put it any way you want. But desecrating the dead would make them exactly like what you described the Taliban doing.
A war crime.
Right? It's a war crime. So you're saying that the Taliban did this, and then our soldiers did this, so don't they equate?
Yeah, it's despicable, but they're dead. You know, once you're dead.
Oh my God!
Well,
okay,
I know,
Peter.
But so in other words, what if the Taliban?
So you think necrophilia is perfectly okay?
What if the Taliban did that to our soldiers? Would you say, hey, they're dead?
I'm sure they've done a lot worse, Peter.
I don't think they've done it so far to our soldiers. Yeah, they're brutal, despicable people. They're right wing religious nuts. So,
you're talking about the Taliban.
Yeah. I mean, the problem is, Dave, is like I was just saying, it's against every single law. And how about this, too? It kind of makes people talk about pissed off at us. Don't you think? Yeah. All right. Thanks.
Well, and this is the whole thing about this is talk about the roots of terrorism. If you really know anything about the roots of terrorism and why these guys are so, no pun intended, pissed off, well, you might want to look into it because it has a little thing to do with what the United States government and Department of Defense has done at the hands of civilians around the world.
Hey, anybody, refresh my brain. What is the series of military law that prohibits
it? Why are we both?
Okay. Let's
brain
go back
parts.
To our, I like this one that's coming, but first we'll go to Mike in Ypsilanti. Go ahead, Mike. You're on the air.
Okay, thank you. Geneva Convention on that.
Thank you.
Well, no, I wasn't even thinking that the United, the Unified Military Code of Justice.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Narrowing it down.
But you're right. You're right. It's also, the United States only cares about, the international law when it's to our benefit.
Yeah. But if someone else does anything, man, we're on it like a dog on a bone.
Right.
Exactly. This is as old as the Iliad of Homer. I don't know if you've seen some of the references in the newspaper.
Sure.
Okay. The dragging of the bodies of the dead, war heroes from the other side. But I got to tell you, that's not why I called. As you, I think the subject matter would have said. But I think you can understand the whole thing on one hand from both sides makes me sick because obviously both sides are killing each other for no reason at all or for oil or what have you.
There you
not
go.
For our own personal interests or our own community interests as a country. And they're upset about desecrating the body, which is obviously a crime. But it's just like, oh, yeah, focus in on this little tiny thing and ignore what the real problem is. It's just senseless murder and war, okay?
This guy was a day before said fighting for freedom. They're not fighting for our freedom. I mean, they're fighting because they're ordered over there. Yeah. They're fighting irregular troops. And one of the things that very frequently raises the anger level of military forces throughout history is that when you have people that aren't proper armies, so they often suffer great abuse.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
All right. A quick thing on the Tim Tebow. I don't, obviously, Jesus is not on either side. I mean, he's on both sides. He's on neither side. But I think I've heard you say many times, Peter, that it was a P.T. Barnum. Any publicity is good publicity.
Right.
Yeah. I'm not sure if, you know the quote.
Right. Any publicity is good publicity as long as they spell your name right.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So it's sort of like, okay, the thing that, I'm not really taking sides, but the phenomenon that that's what's behind it, Tim Tebow, you know, was putting underneath his eyes this John 3:16 quote, right?
Yeah, I saw a picture of that.
And apparently, and I don't know if people are playing with the numbers or not, but they're saying that, he passed for 316 yards during the game, and his average was 31.6.
Which is another verse. Yeah.
Yeah, so the same verse. So, in a sense, it's kind of publicity. What I'm saying is it's not really about Tim Tebow. It's a sense it's about marketing or advertisement. I mean, which I know neither of you do, if you believe in God, it's a good way to potentially get out the message, okay?
Yeah.
That's how I see it. You know what I'm saying? It's still good publicity. Because trust me, Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives both, on every single television and radio network across this nation and more, have been talking about it for weeks.
Well, as I said, I think last week, quoting who? It said, the only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about. Yeah. All right. Well said. Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it. Let's see. Here is Dave. Says he's off the coast of California. Dave, what are you, on a boat?
Well, no. I'm up here on the North Coast. That is to say, I'm in the Humboldt County.
Okay.
Eureka.
Beautiful area. Beautiful.
Wow, yeah. How are the flowers up there?
You people do a real good thing, and so I thought I'd call and share an observation with you. I'm very active with the Occupy groups here.
Great.
And I guess I'm in a pretty progressive liberal area. We've got a big liberal university, the Humboldt State University. And we have an Occupy group there that I'm quite active with. But we stand vigils on the highway. 101 goes through here, and I'd say 50 cars will go by that honk the horns, and some say, "We love you, and please keep it up. Thank you for what you're doing." Then one goes by that you think probably has difficulty being able to read and probably couldn't vote, that makes an obscene finger gesture and tells us to get a job or something.
Oh, yeah, that happened to me when I was out in D.C. at the Bradley Manning thing about every five cars. But keep in mind, we were on an Army base.
Right.
We got the finger.
Get a job!
And we yelled back, "We have one!"
Well, what some of us do is we show up now in the city council meetings and the board of supervisors meetings. And we're letting them know as best we're able. The kind of a ratio we have here, people that are supporting what we're about, and that is overwhelming. Now, that may not be true in other areas. I don't know what it would be like in Detroit right now. I want people to be aware, though, that elected officials, they come up for re-election, but the people are saying, "We like what you're doing." And what they're doing to us is taking away our signs, taking away our tents, they're putting up fences in a way. In effect, what they're trying to say is, "We don't care to hear what you have to say. Why don't you guys get lost? Go be some other place." And what they are, the message.
You're sort of breaking up a bit, Dave. Give me a final summation here, because, like I say, your phone's breaking up a bit.
I think he's up in the mountains there.
Well, if elected officials know that what they're about is that they're trying to silence the people, the people have every right to be aware of that. They need to know where these elected officials stand. They try to blame it on everybody else, the city council. It's really the district attorney of the...
Well, like I say, you're breaking up a bit, so we're going to have to call that. But I'm pleased you're listening way out there in Humboldt County. And the Occupy,
call us back.
Yeah, the Occupy movement lives. I think what you're saying is testimony to that. Occupy Detroit is still involved. They're going to be down at the Martin Luther King Observation at the Central United Methodist Church tomorrow at noon. Jalene and I will be there. That's right down by the Fox Theater and...
right across from the State Theater, and it's basically in the parking lot of
Grand Circus Park.
Comerica Park.
Yeah, it's right by Comerica Park. All right, thanks a lot. Let's see, maybe we can get this one last caller in. Jerry from Wyandotte. Hey, Jerry, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
We're good. What's
up? Remember, we have a whole another hour. You don't mean last call of the show.
Yeah,
but hey,
right.
Hey, Jerry.
Hey, how you doing?
We're good. What's up?
We are doing great.
What's up?
Not much. Just listening to WRIF.
Rocking.
Oh.
Uh-oh, busted. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Nightfall with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Yeah, I just found out why Jay always volunteers to make the office beverage run to McDonald's every day.
Why?
Seems if you buy 5 hot McCafe beverages or premium roast coffees, the 6 months free.
So we've been paying for ours and he's been getting his free?
Yeah.
I cannot believe Jay would do such a thing.
Think of something so genius.
Yeah.
Wish I would have thought of that.
Totally.
It's McCafe Rewards. Collect 5 stickers from any hot, medium, or large McCafe beverages or fresh brewed premium roast coffee, and your 6th one is free. Limited time offer. Ever just made at McDonald's.
Lowe's is giving you more ways to save this winter. Now get 10% off all major appliances priced $397 or more. And update your flooring with free Stainmaster carpet installation with the purchase of any Stainmaster carpet and pad. Plus, save even more this month when you choose 18-month special financing on purchases of $299 or more when you use your Lowe's consumer credit card. Hurry into Lowe's for these and other great values every day. Lowe's, never stop improving. Offers valid through 1-16-12. Special financing cannot be combined with 5% off everyday credit offer. See store for details.
Detroit's Rock Station, on the web. Thanks for listening to WRIF.com.
When there's no one left to call.
this.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
You cannot petition the line with prayer!
All right, so apparently what we're talking about is this whole Tim Tebow phenomena that just got knocked right on their butts.
He'll be back.
45-10, Tom Brady leading the New England Patriots just wiped the floor with Tim Tebow. Half the people almost in America thought that Tim Tebow's success was based on his faith in Jesus and that Jesus was actually giving an unfair advantage to one team. I mean, think about that. Wouldn't Jesus play fair?
One would think so.
And that's not playing fair.
No.
I mean, everybody else is trying their natural best, and he's like...
It's like taking steroids, man.
It is. He's trying his supernatural best. Well, any number of people have said that what I was trying to voice was the Uniform Code of Military Justice, yeah, which forbids the desecration of the dead. And you can say whatever you want about the Taliban. And we don't even know that these people that the Marines pissed on were actually Taliban dead. I mean, right, there's been some horrible cases.
And we mean literally urinated, because yeah, a lot of people can say, you know, that person just totally pissed on my day or whatever. Yeah. We mean literally.
Yeah, and it because there's been some awful cases in Afghanistan and Iraq of U.S. soldiers doing, murdering civilians in the case in Afghanistan, remember, just a little while ago, doing it for fun, posing with photos and all of that.
Awful. Also, my friend Bailey Boudreau, a local writer, actor, producer, is going to be calling in just a little bit, and he's going to give us some of the political highlights from the Golden Globes tonight.
So I don't get the Golden Globe. Who cares what a bunch of foreign film writers think is the best film? You know what? I don't care what the Academy of the Arts.
I hate those shows. That's why we're leaving it to Bailey, yeah, because there's some good juicy political religious stuff. So
I'll settle down.
Yeah, settle down.
But
respect my fellow actor.
I mean, people love all these stars, right, and what have you. So they to see them. And
I saw that Kelsey Grammer. God, he's just vile.
You know? Right winger.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. He won an
There's
award.
There's a few of them.
I thought, oh, come
There's
on.
A few of them out in Hollywood.
Yeah.
All right. Here's Fred in Detroit. Fred, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I was calling, with regard to Tebow, just remember what they say about God. With God, all things are possible.
Well, there you go.
So you have that to begin with. And second is what that lady said about it personally giving him confidence. Now, as far as the guys in Afghanistan and that BS that they pulled,
yeah,
you were talking about the UCMJ, the Uniform Code of Military Justice.
Right.
And I'm an ex-Marine, and I'm a little bit familiar with that. But basically, it comes down to professional ethics.
Yep.
Okay? And I do get tired of people calling these guys with guns kids. No, they're young men that you set off, you know, to fight a war for whatever reason.
Well, you know, Fred, also, when you look at the ages of the dead, I just looked with... The New York Times lists them every day, and today there was one of them, I think it was a Marine, died 44 years old.
Right.
Yeah, so there certainly aren't kids all there.
And the reason that being, Peter, because they raised the age, because remember, they were so desperate to get more people over there.
But also a lot of the National Guard units are over there as well. Yeah. One of the reasons, and they have things like the Uniform Code of Military Justice, is, and they have, like, international law, they don't, you want people to do to you what you would have them, how can I say that? Say it for me.
I'm not sure what
in other words,
for. You don't want that to happen to our troops.
Yeah. You don't want our troops' bodies desecrated. You want to have a standard. I mean, having standards in war is kind of nuts. I mean, when you think about what's going on over the last couple of hundred years. But there's an attempt to make war happen only between warriors, to not use things like poison gas, can't have, you know, torture and what have you. You can't, all that probably isn't adhered to very much. But when you go into somebody else's country, I mean, I guess you, and you're trying to win them over, probably makes some sense not to infuriate them, wouldn't you think, Fred?
Well, yeah, you know, if it's a third world, especially when it's a third world country, it's not like us against the Germans, you know, something of that nature. You have a message you're trying to give these people about American values.
Yeah, they mostly want us out of there. That's,
yeah.
That's the value they want.
True.
Yeah. They do. All right, Fred, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's see if we can pick up on this subject as well. It's Paul from Detroit. Paul, hi, you're on the air. Paul? Paul, are you with me?
Turn your radio on.
Paul, we're going to put you on hold.
But we'll be back to you. Now you'll hear of us in about 30 seconds.
Right. Let's see. Here is Michelle in Commerce Township. Michelle, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes. What I wanted to discuss this evening was I wanted to create awareness for pet owners to protect their canine companions from a new food that's out called Purina Beneples.
A new what?
A pet new food, dog food.
Oh, okay.
Out called Purina Beneples.
Yeah.
It is the main ingredient in there is avocado, and avocado is fatal to canines.
Wait a minute. Why would they? Why wouldn't they know that? Who would feed a dog an avocado? You're supposed to make guacamole with that.
Exactly. It actually contains pyrrhicin, which is a fungicidal toxin.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know this, but Michelle and I talked earlier today, and I was trying to put her in touch with some local media. But that's something I'd like to, I want to look into more, because that's scary, if so. And
after I spoke with you, I went on the Purina website, and I got all of the ingredients, and I was startled to find that there's also garlic oil in there as well.
You don't want that for your doggies.
No, for any canines. They cannot have onions, garlic, shallots, anything in that family.
Right, right. There's a lot of things they shouldn't eat. Raisins.
Yeah, but I was just startled to find that they're actually putting avocado in a food. And it's right on the bag. And I just want to prevent anybody from losing any pets because they had those recalls a few years ago.
And what particular brand is it? Purina what?
It's called Purina Beneples, and it is the Fiesta, Healthy Fiesta is the name of the food, and it's by Purina.
All right, Michelle, we will get on it. Both Jalene and I are dog owners and pet lovers, but we will definitely check it out because we want to protect the pooches.
Yeah.
All right, appreciate you being on that.
And don't leave your dogs outside in the freezing cold, please.
Let's try Paul from Detroit one more time. Paul, are you there with us?
Yes, how you doing tonight?
All right.
Good.
Paul, hi.
Yeah, I just wanted to correct you on that. Uniform Code of Military Justice, because you didn't have it right at first. And, you know, I'm an ex-Marine. I just heard about that from listening to you guys, what happened over there. And, you know, I wouldn't want that happening to me, you know, if I was killed over at seas, you know. Just, that's wrong. And those guys should be punished.
Yeah, well,
absolutely.
That's what the Uniform Code of Military Justice is. I mean, you know,
it's you know.
Well, it sets a bad precedent to begin with.
Yeah, and also you could make the argument as some people have that it's understandable in the pressure of war, the kind of seeing your comrades killed and what have you, the kind of hatred you'd have for the people that are out there. But that's why you have rules, because, for instance, if someone killed a loved one of mine, I might want to go kill them. I mean, that's kind of human nature. But what we have is a set of rules and laws that hopefully are the ones that take precedence. All right, thank you very much, Paul. Appreciate that comment. All right, here, I'm going to let you handle this one. Here is Bailey. Bailey, hi, you're on the air.
All right, yes. Bailey Boudreau, everyone. This is my very good friend. He's a Detroit actor, writer, producer, director, all of those good things. We've worked together in a variety of artistic endeavors. Welcome to the show, Bailey.
You're on the air.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And you watched the Golden Globes tonight. Now, Peter and I, Peter's not a big award show guy, but I've always liked the award shows. But, of course, I'm preparing for the show, so I've left it in your capable hands to let us know some of the highlights as far as, kind of geared toward our show go.
Yeah, well, Peter, as you were saying, you would think Jesus would be fair. He wouldn't pick teams. I think the politics and the arts actually go very hand in hand. Ricky Gervais started out tonight and he said, just thank two people, God and your agent, because they have basically the equal amount of, whatever.
Pull. Yeah. He said he could thank his agent and Jesus equally because basically neither of them have gotten him anywhere.
Right. Exactly. And then I don't want to give any spoilers, although.
Oh, just do it.
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, Meryl Streep did win the Golden Globe for Iron Lady, which of course is a political film about one of the most controversial women and one of the first women in politics. But she thanked her God and agent and said that God was Harvey Weinstein and,
really?
she's very, anti-Bible, but she's very, she made a point to say, this year we have all these nominees, all these great performances and they're, women have really come a long way. I mean, Bridesmaids was up for everything and that was, people were talking about it being the female equivalent of The Hangover, but it wasn't. And
I watched it two nights ago, and it's hilarious.
Really? It is. It's hilarious. Yeah. And it was great to see there's such a wide variety of ages and shapes and colors coming in. I mean, you had Christopher Plummer won for playing a gay man coming out to his son. That 10 years ago would never have been on there.
True.
And what'd you say?
I said true. Yeah. True. Yeah.
But what you were both talking about also with, the set of rules and guidelines that we should follow just kind of to be humans. Laura Dern had a great quote in her speech. She won for the show that she's doing about anger management. But she said the greatest thing is to find bravery and humor in the most unexpected places. And I thought that was great. And then Octavia Spencer, who won for The Help, she said labor that uplifts humanity is the most important thing.
Okay.
And I think...
wonderful things are said, to be sure. But, Bailey, let me ask you a question. I don't even get it. I mean, who votes in this thing? These are foreign correspondents or something?
It's the Hollywood Foreign Press Association.
Which is who?
It's just a bunch of nobodies.
That's what Peter wanted to hear.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
Yeah. But it's a good excuse to get all their gowns on.
Well, this is the one where they drink and they party.
Oh, they get wasted throughout. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Meryl forgot her glasses and she was blind. And Meryl got a standing ovation.
She's the greatest.
She is. And, I think it's a good year because we're seeing a lot of reflection in art and politics. I think in general, even though it may not seem so, that people are becoming more aware. Smaller films about real issues are coming out and getting recognized. I mean, The Artist took like all kinds of awards, and that's something else that was said.
Yeah, a silent film, no less.
I want to see that.
Yeah. I mean, it's got music. It's got great music to it.
Yeah, and it won Best Score, and they said that that
part of the score was from Vertigo, the movie, the Hitchcock film.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, and Kim Novak, who was in that in 1958, complained about it. I forgot the man's name who did the music. It's a long name. Didn't bother to try to pronounce it. I think his feelings were really hurt. But that Kim Novak, who's still alive, was only in her 70s.
I dated this guy who was quite a bit older than me. Sorry, Bailey, but Peter, I got to tell you this story. And he told me that I reminded him of Kim Novak.
Really?
Does that...
You remind me of Jane Mansfield.
Oh, well, let's not go there, baby.
Camp Mansfield was beautiful. Julene, you're pretty beautiful.
Thanks, Bailey.
And I gotta say, Reese Witherspoon totally gave me Lady Wood.
Lady Wood. Do you like that, Peter?
And apparently, in fashion, I get all my clothes at the thrift store, and I always look pretty decent.
Yeah.
But Sarah Michelle Gellar apparently shops at a different thrift store because she was wearing, it was a prom dress from 1978. The rejected Carrie dress.
Oh,
I don't know.
No. Isn't she a Republican?
Sarah Michelle Gellar?
Yeah.
She's a bad actress, so I can't see much.
We'll just throw her over there with the Republicans.
Basically.
All right, give me a few summation here, Bailey. We got to get on to some other callers. I love this. I like the report on it better than I like the
show.
Watching it.
Well, yeah, that's all you need.
Okay.
All you need. So, Bailey, you're going to be back for the Oscars.
Okay, you'll be our cultural correspondent, our Hollywood correspondent.
Our Hollywood correspondent.
Your entertainment correspondent.
Well, okay. I'll tell you what, Bailey. We'll talk to the WRF management and see if we can get them to send you out there to Hollywood. Huh? We'll get back to you, though. All right, Bailey.
Bailey Boudreaux, everybody. And look for his name in lights someday. This is one talented guy.
Indeed.
And a good friend of mine. So thanks for contributing.
All right. Thank you, Bailey. Here is Roy. Roy's in Ann Arbor. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how you guys doing?
We're doing great.
Well, I'm going to have to make this a little bit quick because now I'm hiding in the bathroom at work.
Well, remember, did you hear that one call when this woman said, "Who are you talking to?"
It was a mad wife.
that was excellent. So I guess now I'm more provoked to ask a question.
Go ahead.
I live in Ann Arbor, and out here I deal with a lot of liberal people. I'm neither liberal nor conservative. My question is, why do liberals hate conservatives so much?
Well,
that's a large question.
Yeah, that's very
blanket-like.
It's because that the policies that they support are, and you know, we know conservatives, we work with conservatives, we're friends with conservatives.
My dad's a conservative.
Her dad's
mother, my sister.
Yeah, yeah. But the policies that they advocate are so destructive to everything that I think that defines human society and human decency and support for one another as human beings and the idea that we're all in this together. Instead, they're driven by greed, by rage, by almost negative emotions, aggression, the patriarchy,
fear.
Mongering.
That what?
I may be playing the devil's advocate a little bit here.
Wait a minute. We're the devil's advocate here.
We are the devil. Didn't anyone tell you that?
The thing is, it always seems to me like the liberal drive is to bring people together and to unite one another. Am I correct in that?
We do
a lot of gathering.
Yeah.
I have noticed a couple of times, just a friendly observation throughout the show, that when you mention somebody you don't like, you throw in the fact that they're a conservative. Isn't that sort of separating people from conservatives?
Well, there is the separation. I mean, you got to remember, who was it? Yeah, it was Rick Santorum in this odious, endless campaign for be the nominee of the Republican Party. That said, the whole idea of classes is foreign to the United States. Mitt Romney is talking about class warfare. I mean, you must know, along with everyone else, that class warfare has been practiced against the majority of Americans by this small elite that is willing to go to any lengths in order to maximize their profit. Doesn't matter if it hurts our health or that we wind up with 50 kids in a school class or our roads suck or our housing values are going down the drain. I mean, they just made another $20 billion. The top 10 guys, I mean, maybe one gal, Christy Walton.
In the last 2 years.
In the last year.
Yeah. Right.
So that the money goes somewhere. Money's wealth is created, and where does it go? It could be spread so that we don't have the highest number of poor people, highest percentage of poor people than any industrialized country in the world. It could just go to the military machine on endlessly. Or it could actually go to make this country a paradise instead of when you pick up the paper and let's see, where's the latest mass murder having taken place?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. To say hello to the devil for us.
Get back to work.
Yeah, get back to work.
Oh,
who are you talking to?
It's so hot in here.
Yeah. Right. Here's Steve in Rochester. Steve, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter. I just got off work, so I missed the first hour of your show, but I wasn't sure if you were aware of this story. I wanted to bring it to your attention. There was a wonderful young lady by the name of Jessica Ahlquist,
okay,
out in Rhode Island,
yeah,
that just won a court case to have a prayer banner taken down from her public school.
Okay. Oh, yeah, well,
this is a different one. We were talking about one in Florida.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this young lady, she is just a perfect example of a wonderful citizen of this great country. Her father, since she's a minor, she's 16 years old. Her father put this court case into action for her with the ACLU.
Great.
And unfortunately, it's a crying shame, but she's been receiving death threats through the internet, both her and her family.
Do you think there's any connection between religion and violence?
Yeah.
Wait, that'd be yes.
Yeah.
That's a pretty obvious one, if you ask me. I just, I don't have a whole lot to say. I just wanted to make sure that you were aware of this story and of this wonderful, wonderful young lady.
Well, I wasn't aware of it, Steve, but I do subscribe. I'm a member of and subscribe to the publication of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. It's FFRF.org.
And I am too.
Okay. And yeah. Then, okay.
Me three.
And then they initiate lawsuits like this because Debbie called in earlier, and she said that she was a Christian and she was a liberal. Any liberal Christian knows that the place for the appropriate place for worship is in, what do they call them, houses of worship.
Yeah.
That you don't have to have it out in the public square. You don't have to have it in your schools. You don't have to start political meetings and all these guys beating their chest about how religious they are, more religious than anyone else, because we know the horrible effect that religion and politics create when they're mixed in together. And I always say, you know, one nation under God, Iran. I mean, that's at its worst. Although you go back to the 18th century, the 17th century, back in those times, the Middle Ages, and see the role that religion played in civil society, and then you find out exactly why the Founding Fathers said there shall be no establishment of religion. It's that simple. The people, speaking of the word simple, the people that practice their religion simply, that lead by example, I'm forgetting about a jillion things tonight. Anyway.
What are you searching for?
You show your witness.
Okay.
Yeah, you witness. You be the ethical and moral person in your community. And people go, oh, all right, that's the way I want to act as well.
That's a good model.
But as you know, Steve, in the newspaper, the Freedom From Religion Foundation paper, the Freethinker, there are every issue, two full pages of little teeny weeny stories of how many crimes that religious, not people, but religious leaders have, ministers and rabbis and imams and what have you. It's astounding. This is like the highest amount of criminal activity per profession.
Right, percentage-wise.
Percentage-wise,
right,
yeah, than anybody else. I don't know what it is. You know?
And the laundry list of the crimes committed is really ugly.
Which makes no sense to me because, again,
God's rules, right?
Well, the religious people I know are some of the most ethical, kind, loving people.
Giving.
Giving, engaged in what have you. But
the political process.
You know what? They're political liberals or they're political leftists.
Yeah.
And they're also Christians or Jews or Muslims or Baha'i faith people, or
if only everyone could be like that.
Yes.
They ignore some of the more outlandish aspects of their religion.
Like what?
Well, I mean, a liberal Christian seems to ignore most of the Old Testament.
Well, there's a lot in there that's a little dicey.
I'm all for it. You're speaking to a very proud atheist.
Okay.
But
I'm just so pleased to see that there is in the young people nowadays, 16 years old, Peter. When I was 16 years old, I was still a fundamentalist Christian.
I was searching. I remember.
She's doing amazing things. I just wanted to make you aware of that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
That is amazing.
Appreciate it very much.
Fortunately, she has a father who's on her side who, you know, helped her out with this, because can you imagine just, you know, you're 16. You don't have a whole lot of pull.
Yeah. I wanted, by the way, I said under you that I was searching also, but I was searching for girls.
Yeah, well, and I know you found a few.
Yeah, a few. actually, a lot of times it's how you brought up. So I'm like a third generation atheist.
You're lucky.
Yeah. So, I could say to my dad
or my mom,
is there a guy named, huh? No.
You're so lucky. You didn't have to mess with all that.
Here's another atheist, I think. It's Paul in Sterling Heights. Paul, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, folks. Thanks for putting me on. I thought I'd lighten the mood a little bit.
Oh, okay.
I was given the benefit of a parochial Catholic education in Detroit.
Okay. What school?
Notre Dame.
All right.
And I have to say, unfortunately for my parents' investment, my karma ran over my dogma, if you know what I mean.
My karma ran over my dogma.
That's
good. I love it.
I became a skeptic and an agnostic, but if Tebow can be credited, or if Jesus can be credited with Tebow's success, I want to turn you on to a very amateur but really well put together website by a Lions fan in Detroit. Google Humiliations, The Curse of Bobby Lane.
Bobby Lane?
Bobby Lane was the last championship quarterback of the Detroit Lions.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Who the Lions traded away. This website is a laugh riot, and it's so well put together. Humiliations, The Curse of Bobby Lane.
And so it's a funny
Lane.
It's great.
L-A-Y-N-E. Okay.
Bobby Lane. She's from Iowa. She's from Iowa.
I don't know anything about this Bobby Lane.
You talk about corn, she'll tell you. Bobby Lane, the Lions.
I can sing the Iowa corn song, but I'm going to spare all of you.
Yeah, okay. All right, Paul, thank you very much. You know, it is interesting. One of the things we've been doing all night, Dwayne, hold on, you're our next. Also, some open lines just popped up, 313-298-WRIF.
And we know that we're on one subject, and for all of you who maybe not have heard the show or are afraid to change the subject, feel free. We're all over the place, you couldn't tell.
And afraid, I think the idea that someone, these 43% of the people who think that up until now Saturday night, that Jesus actually intervened directly in Tim Tebow and the Denver Broncos' success, mm-hmm. That I don't know what they would say now. And to us, it's so preposterous to think that Jesus would give an unfair advantage. I never even thought about that.
To anyone.
That is so unfair. Okay, guys, come on. We're gonna do a little more track work. We're gonna practice extra. We're gonna try our human hardest.
Eat our weed.
Then you find out, let me tell you this. I would tell you about the softball game I was in a couple summers ago. It was Detroit Writers versus Detroit Artists.
Yeah, I remember
right?
that you were doing that.
Yeah. I played my old position, second base, and what happened. And so what happened was at these damn artists threw in a ringer. I mean, this young guy, some of the people, we had guys on our team that were in their 60s, and then all of a sudden this guy looks about 26 years old. He's wearing cleats and, what do you call those things? A whole baseball outfit.
Oh, the shin guards?
Yeah, and I'm yelling, I want to see your art! I didn't believe.
That's funny.
And, he hits like a grand slam home run to win the game. So it's the same thing. This isn't fair. I would say. What do you think? Is it fair to have Jesus on your side? I don't think so.
It's an unfair advantage.
Yes. Here's Dwayne in Southwest Detroit. Go ahead. You're on the air.
How you guys doing tonight?
We're doing good. Hi, thanks for calling in, Dwayne.
Oh, I was last week, I think you said something about the medical marijuana and having a gun permit, and you couldn't do that. Did I hear you right?
I don't remember. That was last week. That was a long time ago. Yeah. Man. Must be the medical. Must be the medical marijuana.
Peter,
I got my car.
No, you don't.
I don't. But go ahead. What do you think?
Well, I don't know because I know a couple guys that do it, and I mention it to them, and they're like, "Oh, that's not true."
Wasn't it something that someone was trying to introduce legislation so that you couldn't have a gun and pot plants?
Yeah.
I don't know. Whoever called in about that, because we didn't bring it up. I think it was someone who called in.
So I don't know. Okay. I mean, so you can have what you're saying is you can have.
You can have your pot,
a carry weapon, a carry permit, and also a medical marijuana card. Boy, that scares me.
Well, no, I don't know. I mean, I heard it on your show, so I was, you know, what I hear on your show, I pretty much believe. So,
well,
we appreciate it.
Careful.
Yeah, because if we don't say it,
it should make sense for one thing. So I don't know whether what you're
saying. There's no truth to it.
No, wait a minute. I'm getting totally confused. You're saying you think you heard here that we said you could not have a gun permit and a medical marijuana card.
Correct.
All right. I don't know.
I don't either.
I don't even remember. I don't remember.
I tried calling at that juncture, but I couldn't get through. Yeah. I waited till next week.
Well, that's good. Let's see. One of the things, our collective, I know a lot of conservatives hate that word, but our collective intelligence on this program is pretty high. So let's see if we can
pull it together,
get myself together, and we'll get the answer
well,
for it.
Dwayne. We both have, Dwayne, we apologize, because we really do have, you know, we have pretty good memories.
Yeah, I don't remember
to talk about them.
You know, Southwest Detroit, what's a Journey song where they say, born in South Detroit?
Born and raised in, and everyone says, there's no South Detroit.
It's Windsor.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah.
For those of you who...
Don't stop believing.
Yeah, that's what we used to say to the girls we were going out with. Yeah, Journey's my favorite band.
Oh, God, Peter, that's so pathetic.
But of course, it was really AC/DC.
I like Styx.
Yeah, right. Okay, in fact, we could do that. We could take a break. How about running around in this weather with no pants? Thousands of people. I'll tell you about that when we get back. Man. Also, I'll tell you the shows we're going to have on at 1 a.m., some great interviews ahead.
You're listening to Nightfall with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our final segment. At 1 a.m., I'm going to have a couple of real interesting interviews. In fact, I'm sitting here trying to figure out, Julie, which one to put forth. The first one is with Keith McHenry. He's one of the founders of Food Not Bombs.
Ooh, he's I don't know. That might be first.
He's such an interesting guy. He founded this movement that feeds people in free servings all around the world outside. They have like 1,000 chapters of Food Not Bombs.
Amazing.
And he has been arrested. He's spent over 500 nights in jail for feeding the poor, or not. In fact, they don't even ask, are you poor? You can, if there's a Food Not Bombs sharing, food sharing,
anyone can go.
They don't say, you know, are you homeless? Are you poor? And
like most people are going to go from their, you know, warm, toasty homes with fridges stocked full of food and go to a Food Not Bombs thing just to, you know, cheat them.
I've eaten at Food Not Bombs.
I have too. Yeah. We ate at Food Not Bombs in Miami.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, a big protest there.
That was
a while ago.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. But in any event, for some reason or other, maybe because it also has a political end to it, because the food's okay, but they're not bombs, they don't like it. In other words, if you're going to spend $1 trillion a year on the military, there's going to be a lot of people in your country that are going to go hungry, like is happening here. And Julian reminds us frequently how many children go to bed hungry in the United States or are at risk of hunger.
1 in 5.
Is it that much?
Has gone to bed hungry tonight.
Yeah.
And not just like, I'm hungry. Like, I'm hungry.
Well, Keith McHenry and the Food Not Bombs people have been physically attacked by police forces all around the country. I think I've mentioned this a number of times before. In San Francisco, the San Francisco police attacked this food sharing, I got to get a better word for it, but where they were serving food.
It's like a collective kind of.
So they took all this food, the police did, and threw it in these dumpsters.
And they probably dumpster dived and got it back out.
And then, these homeless people that were homeless went in there and took the food out of the dumpsters. And someone said to the police, well, wait a minute. What about that? And they said, well, they're not breaking the law.
That's just horrible.
Yeah. But now, and you can go to foodnotbombs.net and check it out or listen up. And then, so I guess we will.
I think that should be first.
But wait a minute. Merle Hoffman, I almost called her by my... by one of my first sweethearts named Merle Hoffman, who was one of the founders of the first abortion clinic in New York City.
Oh, wow.
In 1971, she was very young. I think even still, she was very young. She's got to be probably, 60s or 70s mm-hmm. now. And talks about those experiences and what happened to her. Of course, you know, death threats and all of that.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
By religious people.
Wow.
Pardon me. So a couple of good interviews ahead. No pants.
Now, what is that?
It's the other day was the 5th annual No Pants Subway Day. And people, thousands, I couldn't believe these videos. Go just Google No Pants Day. And they have all these videos of thousands of people gathering in New York City. And they go onto the subway and they take off their pants.
Well, there's so a way in their to get attention. Well, at least they're wearing something.
Yeah, well, and it's very bizarre. I'm not quite sure. It's just a lark, I guess. Kind of a strike against conventional.
I can dig that, man.
I don't know. And you're supposed to wear, like, they do it when it's cold. So you wear, like, winter clothing on top and your skivvies.
I don't know.
On the bottom.
Could you do something like that?
Me?
Yeah.
I could.
Yeah. Would you?
I don't know. I mean, depending on what I was doing that day.
Okay.
But anyway.
Depending on your mood.
Matthew writes in the call talk at yahoo.com, the first petitions for the Michigan Constitutional Amendment titled Repeal a Marijuana Prohibition will be printed in a few hours from now. And this, I got this a few days ago on Thursday. They will be spread throughout Michigan by this weekend. Michigan Normal, N-O-R-M-L, which is a national organization for reform of marijuana laws, meets on Saturday in Prudenville. Oh, that's a hotbed of
wherever
the hell that
liberal progressives.
Yeah, yeah. Targowski and Groh, which is a law firm, because I listened. Do you ever listen to this marijuana show? I can't. It's on another station.
I've heard it.
What a stoner show.
It's total stoner. They could use a few tips.
Yeah. They have, like, production.
Well,
so they got music so loud over there. They have music in the back
here. Delivery, even.
Yeah. All right.
Sorry, guys.
Yeah, sorry. But they're going to begin a fundraising campaign for thousands of donors of $1,000 each to raise the first $1 million to put this initiative on the ballot and win. Larger and smaller amounts are welcome as well. We're not asking to pilfer out-of-state funds from needy initiatives in other states, blah, 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 you know. But they're going ahead with this, and let me see. If I get down here a bit, I think I should be able to give you, yeah, repealtoday.org. And so let me see. Let me make sure that's happening so we get that up there. Well.
That's going a little slow there.
Going a little slow, so I hope. They're going to do, oh, yeah. Here it is. Good. Constitutional amendment to end marijuana prohibition in Michigan. And it's, so you got to be 21 years of age for people who are not incarcerated. Marijuana acquisition, cultivation, manufacture, sale, delivery, transfer, transportation, possession, ingestion, presence in or on the body, religious, medical, industrial, agricultural, commercial, or personal use, or possession or use of paraphernalia shall not be prohibited, abridged, or penalized in any manner.
Wow. Yeah. So when is this?
So it should be happening. If you go to repealtoday.org, repealtoday.org, you can get in on this. And that means the police won't have to bother. Well, I don't know. I wonder what would happen.
Well, I think
I was going to say the police wouldn't have to bother with these, with this crime that of smoking flowers.
Yeah, right? No doubt. Yeah. It's been confusing the whole way through. And I knew when that law went through that this is going to be a series of shakeouts and shakedowns.
Talking about medical marijuana?
Yeah, medical.
Yeah. Well, this would just get rid of that. You wouldn't even need a marijuana card or what have you. Yeah.
Just legalize it.
Right. There was this guy that they caught him growing 400 plants in a grow house in Detroit.
Yeah.
And he said, I got a marijuana card. I have a marijuana card.
You can only have 12 plants.
And he said, that's what he said. He said, I misunderstood the limit.
Well, by how many? Hundreds? Oh, boy.
So okay. that would get rid of all this. This will not make you happy, and you probably saw this, that a court-martial has been recommended for Private Bradley Manning for leaking hundreds of thousands of confidential government documents to WikiLeaks.
Yeah, he just went through those the hearings about a month ago.
Right.
And
well, that was sort of like a pre. What do they call it?
It was pre-trial hearing.
Yeah, order to see whether there was enough evidence to suggest
they're going after
reasonable grounds to believe that Private Manning committed the crimes he's accused of, and they say including aiding the enemy, which I don't think they can show.
Well, they can't show that. There's no proof that what he released to WikiLeaks. Caused an eruption in any kind of activity toward U.S. service people or anything like that.
Yeah. He faces life in prison, theft of public records, and computer fraud. That can be...
That's a little scary.
Yeah. He's accused of sneaking out these confidential records. I mean, why were they so available that a private in Iraq...
22-year-old... It was 21 then.
Yeah. Could get all of these confidential State Department files...
Yeah.
...and somehow get them on a Madonna? Wouldn't he hide it on a Madonna CD or something?
I don't remember
that. Did you see Madonna on the Golden Globes?
Yeah.
I mean, what's up with this? She has this huge cross... And but then, you could see almost her entire breasts.
But a lot of people would argue that just because you're a Christian doesn't mean you can don't show your boobies a little. I mean, I'm not advocating for her, but she's not a Christian. She's into...
Wicca, isn't she?
No. Is it Kabbalah?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I think she's Kabbalah.
But that's Jewish, isn't it?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
She's Italian.
Well, she was Catholic. She's gotten away from that.
But she's Italian, and she was Catholic, raised Catholic. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now that we've covered Madonna.
She wasn't very covered, though.
No. Hey, she looks good for her age. You got to give her that. She looks damn good. That woman is a machine.
How old is she?
She's in her 50s.
Really?
Yeah.
Iran, Israel, and the U.S. are all planning military exercises in the Gulf. That's nice. Let's start a war. Israel and the U.S. have called theirs off, so that's good.
So what does that mean? Because they called it off, you know why? Because the other ones called it on.
Yeah, well.
So they're trying to get them to call it off, too.
Are we a little far from home?
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah. Well, one of the things we've been talking about, in fact, remember the guy that called in earlier at 313-298-WRIF and said, why do liberals hate conservatives?
Yeah.
You know, I think of hatred when you describe it precisely really is the way that the conservatives feel about anybody to the left of them.
Oh, absolutely.
that Jalene and I and other people on the left despise the political and social and economic policies of the right wing, the conservative movement that benefit almost exclusively the upper class.
1%.
The 1%, and you know, a few people a little bit below that, but not much. You know, when you talk about the 1%, the 99 people in the 99th percentile, they make $380,000.
In the 1%?
No.
It's above $380,000 for the 1%.
So if you're in the 99th percentile,
you could be making
$380,000, which is, to most people, a lot of money.
A huge amount of
money. But it doesn't seem like that much when you start to, you know, hearing these people that are making, you know, millions and millions and millions, right?
Right.
Right.
Yeah, and then no matter how much money you make, the more you make, the more you make, the more you spend.
Yeah. So the conservative movement represents almost solely the interests of the ultra wealthy. Yet it has these ordinary adherents. We said that the majority of white people making under 50 grand a year voted for the Republicans.
Yeah, I just
What is up with that?
I'll never understand it, and I just wish these people would listen to this show, and because I don't think they think anything about it. I think they're just right on that path, and they've never really been challenged about the amount of money they make versus what these cats in Congress are doing to take them down even further.
Well, I think that there is sort of these single-issue things like guns
abortion. Yeah.
But right now, according to the Gallup poll, 40% of Americans continue to describe their views as conservative, 35% as moderate, and 21% as liberal.
I'm always amazed.
Yeah.
We're always in the minority.
Well, wait a minute. But that leaves 4% for radicals.
Oh, that's us.
That's us.
Yeah, but we're not talking radical, like radical religious terrorists, please. People hear the word radical now, Peter, and they get a little freaked out. We're talking about radical hippies. We're radical hippies.
Why not? But as it is, what would it be? 56% of people are either moderate or liberal. All right, let's see what Warren and Taylor has to say. Hey, Warren, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, how's it going? It's Orin.
Orin, sorry.
No problem. Hey, I was just going to sit there and comment. My brother's got a medical marijuana card and a license to carry a pistol.
Okay.
And now you can't sit there and have marijuana when you got your pistol on you. That's what the law is.
The damn government. What? Get this government off our back.
What is it now? You can't what?
You can't have a concealed weapon permit
and your weed?
And your weed with you at the same time.
Yeah, exactly.
Can they both be in the trunk at the same time?
I don't know.
Nope.
Okay.
All right. Well,
good.
So I guess the law.
Fortunately, I'm okay then because I didn't bring my gun.
Yeah.
God.
That's good. All right. Thank you very much. Here is Aaron in Nova. Aaron, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, I'm only 25, and so as long as I've known anything about the political world, which obviously hasn't been very long, I could never have imagined myself agreeing with anything Republican in any way, shape, or form. Okay, but all this year, you know, I've been starting to listen to this Ron Paul stuff, and basically, especially the anti-military involvement around the world is sounding so great that I'm seriously considering voting Ron Paul and encouraging other people to do so.
You know what? Mm. This may blow some minds. I have registered as a Republican. I really have. This is not one of these jokes. And I'm going to vote in the Republican primary, and I'm going to vote for Ron Paul.
I'm going to do the same.
Yeah.
It's
a tactic.
Well, as a tactic, yeah, because one of the things that Ron Paul has done is to raise exactly that issue, is to legitimize a discussion of the U.S. military and economic empire that stretches all around the world. Something that before, the only people that ever talked about it were people on the left, and they're routinely ignored by, you know, by the major media. I mean, here, you have somebody like Dennis Kucinich, who last election cycle, presidential election cycle, brought that up. But on the other hand, he didn't want to destroy unions. He didn't want to put us back on the gold standard. He didn't want to let things like abortion be, you know, depend upon the state.
Or Social Security.
Social Security or yeah. Medicare or Medicaid, all that stuff. With social domestic issue, the guy is just another bad right-wing Republican. On those issues also, and you probably know but didn't mention, Aaron, is things like civil liberties. He's opposed to the drug war. He's opposed to the Patriot Act.
What we always say is he's 50% good, but he's 50% horrific. Really.
But wait a minute. Hold on, Aaron. Couldn't you say the same thing about Obama?
I mean, he's terrible on war.
The
numbers. I don't know.
Yeah, he supports the Patriot Act. He supports the war on drugs.
Right.
Yeah.
But Ron Paul's scary part is too scary for me. He wants to break down all of those institutions.
Yeah, he does. In some ways.
To the states? Nah.
Yeah.
All right, but like you guys mentioned, the Democrats being better than a stick in the eye. What bigger stick in the eye than saying, oh, we're going to bring the troops home, and then saying, I changed my mind. You know, that being like one of the biggest points that made me want to vote for him. Okay, we're going to get out of these wars. We're going to bring all these people home. And then, changed my mind now that I'm in office. We're actually not doing that.
Oh, wait a minute.
Troops came home from Iraq. They came home.
And then instead, now they're just privatizing it.
It was already privatized over there. The contractors who were over there, they were already there. They're just staying.
You know, there is an unfortunate political reality, and I'm not. I don't want to get forced into a thing where I'm defending Barack Obama.
Yeah.
But Ron Paul says that if I was president, I would dismantle all of the bases, depending on how you count it. I don't know why we can't get a figure. 700 to 1,000. U.S. military bases. We wouldn't intervene in countries around the world. But, you know, if all of a sudden, through some weird thing, he became president, you can say, okay, I'm signing this paper, and they're all out of there. I mean, you have to move in a manner that is, that is reasonable within a pretty creaky political system, to the point where even when you have a majority, that you're hamstrung by the opposition. So, Obama gets reelected, I'm curious to see where he'll move a little more forthright to the left, because right now he's just really a center rightist, right?
Right.
Yeah. So, I'm not defending Obama. He did end the war in Iraq. There is a withdrawal date from Afghanistan. I suspect, from what you're saying, Aaron, like me and Jalene, we would prefer that if the day one he got in the office, okay, Guantanamo's closed, I'm withdrawing the troops from both wars.
Oh, that would have been beautiful.
Yeah, the fact that he didn't made people like us think, what the hell is this guy all about? Why do we get so excited? Well, I never was that excited about him.
Yeah.
Well, me neither, but I, like you guys said, better than a stick in the eye. And then I really felt like, wow, my eye.
Yeah.
Well, but here, Aaron, what I've always said is that the only way, that old bumper sticker, I don't know if you've ever seen it on a car that says, if the people lead, the leaders will follow. If we're putting all of our eggs in the basket of either, even Ron Paul, who isn't going to get the nomination, of Barack Obama or Willard Romney, we're screwed. So we've got to reinvent the future, particularly someone, you know, your age has to consider that.
Essentially.
Yeah. And that means getting involved in these political movements. I mean, I guess I wouldn't be that critical if someone was in the Ron Paul movement, or I would say, look at what it's going to do to aspects of domestic policy. However, things like the Occupy movement, things like this, in 11 hours, Jalene and I will be down at Central United Methodist Church. That's in a great downtown near the Fox, right near Comerica Park.
And what it's for is Martin Luther King
Day. Yeah. And it's going to, what's being shaped here is a real opposition movement that has those definitions that Ron Paul brings up, because he's not the only one. In fact, he's the only one on the right. He's the only one among the conservatives. All right, we're going to have to let it go at that because we're out of time. Thank you so much for being our last caller, Aaron.
Yes, thank you.
We'll continue all of this. If you're off tomorrow, come on down and join us. There's other Martin Luther King observations.
All over the city. In fact, if you go to the Free Press's, Detroit Free Press's website,
yeah,
freep.com, there's a whole list. There was a whole page of events that are going on tomorrow. But we'd like to see you at ours, and, well, ours, the one we're going to. And we want to thank Athena for answering the phones
oh, yeah,
and doing
you,
everything
Athena.
Great. For a podcast available at noon tomorrow at either, well, go to our Facebook page or peterwerby.com. You can direct it through there.
Or how about, what's that other thing?
WRIF.com.
Yeah, that's good. All right, folks, next week.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. I think the best way to get into this book is to read the biography of the man that that we're going to interview. The book is called Hungry for Peace, How You Can Help End Poverty and War with Food Not Bombs. Some of you may remember Keith McHenry. I interviewed him several years ago when his first book came out about his organization. But let's talk just a little about what's on the back of the book here. It says, artist and author Keith McHenry helped start Food Not Bombs in Massachusetts in 1980. He has recovered, cooked, and shared food with the hungry for over 30 years. He's been arrested for his involvement with Food Not Bombs, spending over 500 nights in jail. At one point, he faced life in prison. He has traveled all over the world, speaking at colleges, bookstores, and cafes while sharing free vegan meals with many of over the 1,000 Food Not Bombs groups active around the world. When he isn't on the road, Keith lives in Taos, New Mexico. He tends his garden, he writes, paints, and helps coordinate logistics for the Food Not Bombs movement. We're reaching him now in Tucson, and welcome to the broadcast. I can do better than that. Welcome to the broadcast, Keith McHenry. There you go.
Well, thank you, Peter. That's fantastic that you have me on. That's so cool.
And even though we record this, I don't even edit out my own mistakes. People see me raw. But anyways, let's talk about your book, Hungry for Peace. How many years ago did we talk? When did your first book come out?
Well, the first book came out, the first edition of it, was in 92. And that was... It came out just in time for the quincentennial of I think that's what it's called, whatever it was, when Columbus allegedly discovered America. And it was just in time for our first Food Not Bombs gathering, and where about 70 people came, and that's where we ended up determining the principles of Food Not Bombs, which exist to this day, that the food is always vegan and vegetarian, free to anyone without restriction, that we're dedicated to nonviolent direct action to change society so no one has to eat at a soup kitchen, and that we don't have any leaders, that we use a process called consensus to make decisions. So that's when the first book came out. It was published by New Society Press in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia. And then subsequently, two more editions have come out by C Sharp Press. And I sold the very last copy at a festival in Prescott, Arizona on September 28th. 2 years ago, and I went for a year without any books, which was very hard in the kind of effort to organize Food Not Bombs, because that's really, this is sort of the handbook that tells you how to, why you would organize a group like this, how you would do it, how you would prepare meals to feed people, and strategies on how to organize things like occupations, protests, community gardens, things like that.
Well, so it could have been almost 20 years since we talked, but that's possible. But let's go through some of what was in your little bio on the back of Hungry for Peace, how you can help end poverty and war with Food Not Bombs. And people were saying, now, wait a minute. He feeds people, and he spent over 500 nights in jail, and at one point faced life in prison. But then, wait a minute, now he's talking about occupations and protests, so that maybe he really was doing something that that brought the police in. So you couldn't have faced jail simply for feeding people.
Well, the real problem for the authorities was the fact that we were pointing out that there was more than enough resources and food to feed the hungry, that there were all these hungry people, which we were not supposed to really know about. You know, many official efforts to drive them to the edges of town and out of sight. This was in San Francisco, were happening. And there were even a major program called the Quality of Life Enforcement Matrix Program, which Mayor Frank Jordan started to try to hide the homeless problem and try to avoid tax dollars going to things like education, healthcare, and stuff that would be make it so that less people would be in poverty and poor in San Francisco. And the people behind the effort were Bechtel Corporation, Chevron, Bank of America, and other military contractors that were feeling threatened that money would be diverted from their from what they were hoping to continue to profit at, and then instead it would be redirected to things that would really help the local population. And so that was what the overriding concern was, because you would see us out in public in front of City Hall or at Golden Gate Park feeding hundreds and hundreds of people, and that with a sign, with signs saying food not bombs, and with literature about, you know, how, where our tax dollars are going and so on. And that was a major concern. So they tried all kinds of attempts to get rid of us. Originally, we just got arrested on infractions for having a picnic without a permit.
Let me just back you up a bit. So you're out in Golden Gate Park, you're in front of San Francisco City Hall, and you're feeding people, and you don't ask if they're homeless or if they have money. Whoever comes up and wants to eat can do it, but it very frequently it is the poor and the homeless that want to come to Food Not Bombs meals. And you actually got arrested, so what happens to the food when you...
Well, at first we made the mistake of bringing all the food out and serving it, and of course the cops came and took it all. And they, the strange thing at the beginning, the first couple of arrests in August of 88, they gave the food to a neighboring soup kitchen. So if the food was a problem, then why did they deliver it just to another soup kitchen? And of course, fortunately they were dumb enough to make some, public comments on the TV that they weren't concerned about the quality and the safety of the food, but the issue was the political message that we had. And so originally you get like we were held for 12 hours, the first a couple of arrests, but then it got more serious. They ended up, the first occupation we did was in 1989, where a group of homeless people organized the occupation outside of City Hall for the civil rights of the homeless in San Francisco, and they were inspired by the students over in China during Tiananmen Square. So we fed them, and at the end of 27 days of having a 24-hour day kitchen, the police shut the thing down. And then we started getting arrested again for sharing food without a permit. This time they abolished the permit process, and they got a court order against us serving food at one point. But then the issue was we realized we had to divide the food into thirds. So we would come out with just a token amount of food for the police to seize. Then they would arrest and we'd have another wave of volunteers come out, get arrested, and some more food seized. And then we would come out with all the rest of the food and feed everybody. So we sustained twice a day, feeding between 300 to 500 people a day, even though we were also having 6 to 10 arrests a day for sharing those meals. And we did that for... in these different waves. You know, eventually they get the earthquake in 89, Loma Prieta earthquake, ended that second wave of arrests. But then when the mayor came in, the chief of police came in as mayor in 93, we ended up with another, what became 700 arrests. And these were for felony conspiracy to serve food in violation of a court order. And they got an injunction, permanent injunction against us feeding people without a permit. And then they abolished all the permit process completely, so there's no way you could get a permit. And that was how they organized that to justify their arrest. And then I had 47 felony conspiracy arrests at one point, charges pending, and I got framed in two different matters where I was faced the California three strikes law, and I was the first white person to face that.
And you could have gotten life in prison for that.
Yeah, I was facing my original bail was $250,000, and then I was facing 25 to life. And there was a lot of energy towards trying to do that by the government. It was spent a lot of effort on that. But eventually, we didn't really win by legal means. We had the business community kind of decided that it was too crazy, since there was United Nations was advocating an end to the arrest and a dropping of my charges, UN Human Rights Commission in Switzerland, and also the Amnesty International, and many other human rights groups were organizing really large campaigns to stop the attacks against food not bombs in San Francisco. And it was that kind of international political pressure that ultimately got the Clinton administration to then pressure the Democrats in San Francisco to end this campaign.
That's amazing. My guest, if you're just joining us, is Keith McHenry, and he's the author of Hungry for Peace, How You Can Help End Poverty and War with Food Not Bombs. And Food Not Bombs does public feedings of people with recovered food. It's vegan, it's vegetarian. And we were talking about Keith McHenry's run-ins with the law. Well, that was quite a few years ago. Well, maybe do this in your answer. Do you still face that kind of police repression when in other cities since then? And explain just a little more about the whole feeding process itself, if you would.
Yeah, well, the issue of how we organize the food is we're all volunteer. There's no paid staff anywhere. We realized if anybody was going to get paid, it should be the people we're feeding. And obviously there's too many people to, you know, need food to be paying everybody. And we wanted it to be something that every person could do, that it didn't have to be a, you know, that you had to have a lot of money to do it. So the food is recovered. That's how I started. I was a produce worker in Cambridge, Massachusetts, throwing out all this beautiful organic food in one of the earliest commercial natural food stores, Bread and Circus. And I was just devastated by that waste, and I started taking it to this housing project not far away from where the store was, and it was really super appreciated. And that turned me on to the idea. And then, so that's what all of us do, is we go around and we talk to managers of produce markets. We really do focus on organic because, you know, there's a lot, enough of that being discarded to, you know, make it possible to really feed everybody. You know, there's recent studies have shown that 40% of the food produced in the country is discarded. And a recent UN study showed that if you took all the food from Britain and the United States that was being thrown away every day, you could feed the 1 billion people that are going hungry every day on Earth.
That's
so
extraordinary. Absolutely. Yeah,
it's an amazing, amazing thing. So anyway, that food we just collect, and we make it into meals, a bunch of it. You know, we'll make into, you know, enough food to feed all the people we expect to have show up at our meals. And then we also take the other food that we didn't prepare and just bring it out with us. And then, and, you know, we call it like shopping for free. You know, you get to just, we bring out bags for people to take away what they want. So an astounding thing is it's not only the homeless that are eating with us. We even have, you know, house people eating with us because, you know, things are so rough in the United States. You know, roughly half of all Americans are struggling to survive. So we do, then after, you know, we also will have a literature table with information. That table played a huge, I was in Iceland on my way to a food recovery conference in England, in Northampton, at the Northampton University in England. And I stopped off because the cheapest way to get there nowadays is through Iceland, on Icelandic Air. And so I spent some time in Iceland when they were doing their food not bombs, and they still do that. And it was incredible. They not only had the literature like we do in the chapters, but they also had little signs that they made reproducing the flyers with Sharpies, because it was so cold people didn't want to take their hands out of their pockets, out of their gloves to get flyers. Well, the conversation from those little signs and from the literature, inspired a march one day to the Parliament building, which is just a couple blocks away from where we share. And that march at the end of that, when people came back the next Saturday to eat, they decided to do another march. Eventually, those marches got so big from the Food Not Bombs meal, and there was all this writings in the local media about the discussions that came out of the meals and so on. And that's part of our idea, is to create a space where people talk about the events of the day and seek solutions and try to inspire to do, all kinds of, like whatever needs to really happen. One of the meals in Eugene generated the idea of a program that we have called Food Not Lawns, where we teach people how to do community gardening. And that, of course, you could see in the Detroit area has become a hugely successful community effort. Not necessarily the Food Not Lawns, but, other community gardens. And then we had another thing called Homes Not Jails that derived out of the meal. So that's where we take over abandoned buildings, fix them up, and people that have been forced onto the streets are encouraged to move in and get off the streets.
Well, people are finding this intriguing, and I can't imagine that you're not. It's there's a website that Keith McHenry and Food Not Bombs will share a lot of information with you at. It's foodnotbombs.net, and it, among other things, includes a list of affiliates all around the world. So I know some of you are even listening in Europe and Asia and in Latin America. So you can there's things happening there, and there's things happening right here in our Detroit area, right? You mentioned before our broadcast that there were groups in Michigan.
Yeah, there are a lot. Most recently, I've been getting huge amounts of emails from Grand Rapids, Michigan, Ann Arbor. We've had projects in the Detroit area now since I think about 1989 is when we had started our first meals out of on Trumbull. I'm not clear exactly what Detroit. I know that we were really organizing around a thing called the Social Forum.
The United States
Food Not Bombs was super active in that.
Right. The United States Social Forum in June of 2010, I guess it was.
2010.
Yeah.
It was a huge event. So there, and then across, I've been getting a lot of emails from across the river over in Windsor, in Ontario. We have a really amazingly active movement there too. It's like in Guelph and Toronto and St. Catharines. It's just an amazing amount of things happening in that region.
Well, get you to draw from your book, Hungry for Peace, How You Can Help End Poverty and War with Food Not Bombs. It includes the history, it includes political stuff, it includes recipes on how to create, big feedings of, I don't know, feedings isn't good. It sounds like the zoo, doesn't it?
We'll call it the sharing.
So if you want to do, there's for six, but there's also larger servings as well. But one of the things I found intriguing in the book, Hungry for Peace, How You Can Help End Poverty and War with Food Not Bombs, and I should tell people, too, it's published by C Sharp Press. You can go to csharppress.com. It's S-E-E for the C in there. Also, foodnotbombs.net, and, of course, my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. There'll be a link as well. But from this book, if a group is going to start Food Not Bombs sharing, food sharing, and they're doing it, let's take a little town. They say they're going to do it in Greenville, Michigan, all right? And, of course, the police in Greenville have never seen anything like this, and they totally freak, right? Because if anything is out of the ordinary, that's what they're there to stop. So what happens generally when this all begins? Tell us the process, and if they get stopped, what do they do? I thought this was some great stories.
Yeah, well, basically there's a little system that we've learned kind of works. In reality, most towns don't bother us, I know a lot of people know of us through the arrests. So we just had a bunch of arrests in Orlando this past summer, and right now we have a struggle in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. And so essentially what happens is usually I'll get an email or a call from a local chapter, as it happened just about a week ago from Myrtle Beach, and they'll say, wow, the police have been coming around telling us it's illegal to do this, and they've actually made like a law in Myrtle Beach when after Food Not Bombs started, where they're limited to four times a year that they can share food. And that's modeled after a law that was created in Orlando, Florida, which we were being arrested for. So then the system is that we're like, it turns out actually, even though there's these broad laws, can occasionally be made specifically about a Food Not Bombs chapter, we will then say, well, it should be our lawful right to do this. It's a First Amendment activity. So we'll contact the local ACLU and National Lawyers Guild, ask them to come out. We'll hold a rally on the, say, if you're sharing food every Saturday at noon at the library, we encourage everybody to come there at noon at the library, tell the media that we're doing this, that we will prepare for it by having some nonviolence trainings nonviolent preparations where we will determine who's going to be the legal support and who's going to be who's going to risk arrest and who's going to water the plants at that person's house and walk their dog if they are in jail and so on. And the reality is almost 100% of the time, it's relatively rare that on that day when you have the rally for the right to share free food and work for peace, the police might come and they'll just stand around and they'll just chat with you. They won't actually even threaten to arrest you. The media will interview you. You'll end up having some great local stories about how you collect the food and where you collected the food from and why you're doing it and how it's part of a global campaign that is happening. And then your group will have like all these new volunteers. You'll have local stores calling you up to say they have extra food too. And more people will show up to eat with you because they've heard about you now in the media. And your chapter of Food Not Bombs will just flourish. And that's, we can see like that happened in Salt Lake City before the Winter Olympics. It happened right now there's a thing happening in Santa Monica also where there was threats of arrest in California at Santa Monica, and there's been this big news barrage about it, and we have more and more volunteers at that chapter. So there was very rarely arrests outside the U.S., but there were some arrests in Brixton, England a couple of years ago, three arrests, and now there must be 10 or 15 chapters in the London area that just grew out of that one news story. So that's essentially what happens. It's a strange way to promote a flourishing of a movement, but that's why we are in 1,000 cities, is because initially of the, you know, when we were arrested in 1980.
Well, let me interrupt you one second because we're almost out of time. This has flown by. That's why.
Wow, that's incredible.
You have this great book, Hungry for Peace. But do you consider this charity? Is this charitable work on your part?
No, actually, that's a big issue that has been debated. We actually don't think of it as charity. Our goal is to change society so no one has to eat in a soup kitchen. And that goal has been a threat to other food programs, which we don't, you know, we're, you know, we actually deliver food to other food programs. But, you know, there's a concern that we're pointing the finger at the way society is organized. And obviously, we have enough food, as I was pointing out. We have a huge percentage of our resources go to the military, but they also go to other crazy things that are not really helping the people. And that if our resources were diverted towards other things like healthcare and education and so on, and that our focus was on the actual well-being of the community, clearly there would not have to be any homeless people living on the streets, or very few. And, you know, I'm old enough. I started this in 1980 when Reagan just came to power, and there was not a huge homeless population. There were people living in public housing. There was poverty. But, you know, that has, in the 30 years, the Reaganomics has sadly turned our country into a country where half the people are struggling to live. And so the solutions to hunger and poverty are not in the preparing the meals and giving it to the people. That's something that's super important in a climate like this. That needs to happen. But the real solution is in changing society so that no one has to be living in a situation where they have to go seek food at a soup kitchen.
Well, Keith McHenry, just in 60 seconds, and then we're out. You've been doing this actually for over 30 years, and there's so much involved here. You sound so buoyant. You're not tired. You're not exhausted.
No, it's just so exciting. I mean, in the last week, for instance, there was one day where I received emails from, like, almost every continent on Earth with questions about how to do food not bombs or news about what they were doing. And you just meet all these amazing people. So to me, I just could not be more excited. And there, you know, while on one hand the economy is getting worse and we're facing potential war with Iran, which is really devastating, which could devastate the economy even further. On the other hand, so many people are thinking outside the box. The occupation movement is expanding. That's something I've been very involved with. And so there's so many people seeking fundamental new perspective on how the world is organized, and I think we're at this amazing time in history where that certainly, because of all the crises, could be something that transpires, and so I just am excited to be involved in that.
That's great. And, you know, listeners, oftentimes people say, well, gee, I don't know what to do. Here's one thing you could do. It's Food Not Bombs. It has lots of different facets in it. And the book is important because it's a history, it's a how-to, it's a recipe book, and it's just an engaging piece of literature. It's Hungry for Peace, How You Can Help End Poverty and War with Food Not Bombs. It's published by C Sharp Press. That's S-E-E. CSharpPress.com is where to go. Food Not Bombs, which will even give you a list. So you don't want to start one right from scratch. Right here in the Detroit area where you're listening around the world, you can go to foodnotbombs.net and get hooked up with groups that are already there. I'll have a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Keith McHenry, the author of the book, has been my guest. Thanks so much for being on the broadcast.
Thank you so much, Peter. It's really great, and I look forward to getting calls and emails from everybody out there and listening to the program. It always happens, and it's really exciting.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
words were written on the studio wall.
Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. So far in this primary season, that the issue of abortion hasn't come up real greatly among the Republicans. That's one of their red meat issues. And there are some people that I know that have fairly liberal views on most other things. Let's say I'm going to vote for the Republicans because they're opposed to abortion. They want to end a woman's right to choose. So the idea that after almost 40 years, we are still debating what has become a standard medical procedure is kind of daunting, but it's something we have to continue to address. And I can't think of anyone who is better able to address this than Merle Hoffman. She's an award-winning journalist, activist, and women's health care pioneer. She founded the first ambulatory abortion center in 1971, and it's also become one of the nation's largest women's medical facilities. She's the founder of the New York Pro-Choice Coalition and a co-founder of the National Abortion Federation. She also is the publisher of On the Issues. It's an online feminist magazine. We are reaching her in Queens at Choices, at the medical facility for women. She's written a book called Intimate Wars, The Life and Times of the Woman Who Brought Abortion from the Back Alley to the Boardroom. Merle Hoffman, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
I'm very, very pleased to be with you, Peter.
You know, lately I've been starting interviews by asking people about the titles of their book. They always seem to suggest so much. Why in Intimate Wars? This just seems so public.
Well, it shouldn't be. That's really the point. I mean, one's decision about reproductive choice, whether or not or when to have a child, is one of the most intimate, personal decisions that anyone could make. But because of the political nature of the decision of the issue, it has become an extraordinarily public situation. So we are in a war. We're in a war to keep our freedom of choice and our reproductive freedom. And the war is actually a very intimate one because every woman's personal decision becomes a public battle. And that's why I called it Intimate Wars, and because women's bodies are actually the battlefields of all of these political battles, and we are all part of this struggle, whether we're recruited or not, whether we signed up or recruited or not, we're part of this battle.
The people I call, and I probably should try to be a little more objective, the people I call the compulsory pregnancy movement the anti-choice people, would argue that, in fact, this is sure that it manifests itself privately, which is the basis of the Roe v. Wade decision, but that ultimately it is a public decision about how we define ourselves, and these are unborn children, so that and society needs to nurture them as a total. How do you answer that?
Well, I think this was answered actually in 1973 by the Roe decision, because it gave an interest to the concept of this ongoing creation of a human being. And it said in the first trimester, this is a decision between a woman and her physician. In the second trimester, the states have a right to regulate as the fetus is growing. In other words, in later gestational periods. And in the third trimester, that abortion could only be done to save the life of the mother. So the court recognized the growing demands of the fetus, actually, on the public, on the societal collective. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, and I think many women and many people of conscience are concerned, the right to reproductive freedom and to define when and whether you want a parent is a fundamental human and civil right. So, yes, they do define this is a baby, you know, at the moment of conception, when the sperm and the egg meet. This is why so many of these anti-choice people are vehemently against birth control also. So this is a very dangerous situation, you know. I mean, Roe allows for the state to regulate abortions in later gestations, and I think that that's a livable compromise, certainly.
My guest is Meryl Hoffman, and she's written Intimate Wards, The Life and Times of the Woman Who Brought Abortion from the Back Alley to the Boardroom. And I want to get back to just some of the controversy around abortion. But I think it's important to also talk about the positive developments that have occurred for women's health and women's right to choose in the 40 years or so that you've been dealing with this issue. Tell us about that subtitle, about your life that brought abortion from the back room, back alley to the boardroom.
To the boardroom. Well, you see, you know, I started Choices 2 years before the Supreme Court decision in 1973. In 1970, there were four states that decriminalized abortion prior to the decision, and New York was one of them. So something that was abortion, which was a word that was whispered and talked about or discussed in criminology classes or theology classes, all of a sudden, you know, results in hundreds of thousands of women showing up at the early clinics in New York City to have the procedure. So you have to really imagine this. It was like a world turned upside down. One day, you know, you were a criminal. You could, if you wanted to have an abortion, if you could find somebody who could do it and that you wouldn't be butchered or you wouldn't die. The next day, you can go into a facility and have a legal medical procedure. So it was a profound, profound change. I had just sort of fallen into it. You know, I was studying to be a concert pianist. Then I went to college for psychology. I had tried many different artistic venues, and then I took a part-time job at one point in time because, as you know, being an artist is very difficult to make a living. And it was with a physician, and when the law changed, he was involved, and so was I, in starting this small practice to provide, and we weren't large, we were seeing about 3 or 4 patients a week for quite a while, to provide legal abortion services. And for me, it was the first patient who came to Choices, and she came from New Jersey, okay, because abortion was still illegal in New Jersey. And she was terrified. She was white, and she was married, and she had one child, but she couldn't afford another child. So I had to talk to her. I mean, I didn't know what to say, what she would say, but I did, and I held her hand throughout the procedure and stayed with her and talked to her, and it was her hand that catalyzed me, her hand that really inspired me, and I was profoundly moved, and it was really the beginning of my entire life in this work. And as a result, I developed a series of patient power, which was to activate women to be more assertive within their medical decision-making. I became politically involved. I debated all over the country when Henry Hyde passed the Hyde Amendment.
And you debated Jerry Falwell, of all people.
Yeah, this is what I was going to... I debated Jerry Falwell, and I debated him in Detroit.
Really?
On television, in 1983.
Tell us, well, you know, we're so chauvinistic here in our little big town, or big little town, whatever you'd call it, here in Detroit. What
right.
What were the circumstances?
You know, I really can't remember, but I do know that he was there, and I went down there to, you know, to debate him, and I don't know why we were in Detroit, but we were there. And I'll tell you that it was very interesting because he looked at me and he said, "Miss Hoffman, how many abortions did your facility do last year?" And I looked at him and I said, Reverend, well, we did about 9,000. And he said, well, how would you feel when you meet your maker with the blood of 9,000 babies on your hands? And I told him, Reverend, I'll be proud when I meet her to tell her that I fought for women's rights. And he said, her? Her? Are you saying God is a woman? And I said, no, God is beyond gender. So that's my Jerry Falwell story.
Wow. Merle Hoffman is my guest. She founded Choices 40 years ago, and now it's become the largest women's medical facility, or one of them, in the United States.
Right.
And also, just in the book, it says the first ambulatory abortion center. Does that just mean walk-in, or what? I didn't understand ambulatory there.
Yeah, ambulatory means that it is walk-in. I mean, there are hospitals. In the beginning, mostly hospitals did abortions where you stayed overnight, but this is a day surgery.
Okay, so tell us some about Choices. It's not just an abortion clinic, although there are some facilities that only provide that service. So you have a wide range there at Choices.
We have a wide range of services. We have mental health services. We have a large prenatal program. We have doulas that work with the prenatals. And it's very interesting that a lot of our prenatal patients were previous abortion patients. And then when they can and when they decide to have their children, they actually come to us to have their prenatal care. We also do full series of gynecological procedures, family planning, birth control and sterilization procedures. We have a very strong outreach program where our speakers go out to high schools and different groups and teach about birth control, abortion, and women's rights.
You know, it's interesting, just a little side note here. Longtime listeners will remember that I have never interviewed anybody from New York City where there hasn't been a siren in the background. I don't know.
You know, isn't that interesting?
But anyway, all right, here, Jerry Falwell. So how many years ago was that, 25 years ago?
In 83, my God.
83, so it's almost 30 years ago. He's referring to you essentially as a baby killer. And some of those...
Oh, God, and then...
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean... Yeah, I was going to say, I wanted to say to him, you know, take a number, the line forms to the left, because I've been called everything in the book, you know, one of the big, big attacks is, oh, well, you're in the abortion business. And I said, oh, no, I'm in the women's lives business. I'm in the business to help save women's lives, you know? And then I've been called a Hitler, too, so that's not unusual.
Well, hasn't, though, the language worked better for the people that oppose abortion? Abortion than because you say pro-choice. On the other hand, people recognize that phrase right away. Merle Hoffman, you're a baby killer. Merle Hoffman, we're in the pro-life sector of American society, meaning you're anti-life and you kill children. I mean, that's a pretty horrible indictment.
It is a horrible indictment, and they have been very clever and very strong and have managed to occupy the language and the debate. And now I'm asking pro-choice people and the thousands and the millions of women who have had abortions and their friends and their husbands and their lovers to occupy the abortion debate, the abortion dialogue with truth. We have to occupy this issue with the truth. And we are not baby killers. We save women's lives. I mean, women's health has had a tremendous positive impact on millions and millions of American women's lives in this country, and legal abortion is the same. So, you know, the problem, or one of the problems, is the pro-choice movement itself. I mean, there's a reticence. There's not enough of a proactivity to go up against this language, this thinking, this philosophy, and we're going to work on that.
Well, that's one of the reasons I often use the phrase the compulsory pregnancy movement, that that the police power of the state and the judicial system is employed by one group in society who has a view of when human life begins and what the choices are, to involve the state in you know, carrying out their wishes. Although the idea that abortion would end if abortion was constitutionally or by statute abolished, then all the abortions would stop, right?
No, of course. Well, you know, that's somebody's dream, but it's certainly not reality. Again, we have to talk about the truth. There has been abortion all throughout history. Women have always put their lives on the line to determine when they're going to be mothers. It will not stop abortion. To criminalize abortion will never, never stop abortion. What it will do is just drive more women to the back alleys, and there won't be enough coffins to hold them. That's what it will do.
people that have a memory of some of these pro-choice rallies and demonstrations in, say, the 70s and the 80s and what have you, may remember a young woman holding up an enormous coat hanger. This was Merle Hoffman, I guess, who was just published Intimate Wars, The Life and Times of the Woman Who Brought Abortion from the Back Alley to the Boardroom. Tell us a little about that, and when you and tell us why. I wonder, since so much time has passed, whether the iconography of a coat hanger still resonates with everybody, say people under 30 that are listening.
It probably doesn't here at all, because so many young women don't know, can't remember because they weren't alive, don't relate, because there's I think a lack of political empathic response, and with a lot of people in the country, so we're in a situation, oh well, they feel entitled, it'll never happen, but that's the danger. It will and can happen. And now there's over 100 anti-choice legislative attempts, more than ever. I mean, if the right wing does not make abortion illegal, they are sure as hell going to make it impossible. So the hanger at the time was a symbol of the future of women if abortion would be criminalized again, because this was a very common thing that women would use. They would insert things into their cervix to get into their uterus to start a miscarriage or an abortion, and the hanger was a very common thing that was used.
How did people react when you showed up with that big hanger at these demonstrations?
Well, in the beginning there was a lot of debate about my using it, because I worked in coalition, and some people were uncomfortable, and they didn't think it was quite the absolute icon for the pro-choice movement, too depressive, and da-da-da-da. Meanwhile, it was very powerful as an image, and now pro-choice, they started to make pro-choice little necklaces and all sorts of jewelry with hangers after that, so it became ubiquitous. First it was shocking, and then it became ubiquitous.
Merle Hoffman, your book certainly reflects an engagement and a commitment, and talking to you, I get the same thing. I almost think, going through your book, Intimate Wars, and looking at all the photographs, you would almost be exhausted by all of this, by being in this battle for 40 years, but and you laugh some. So is that...
I do. I sometimes feel... I'm in Groundhog Day. You know that moment when
yeah,
I wake
sure.
up and it's the same day? When I wake up and I hear the same arguments, and I walk to the mirror and I look at myself, I say, oh no, it's 40 years later. But it creates the same passion in me, the same intensity, the same rage, the basic same, how dare they? How dare they? And I think all resistance starts with that one word, no. And, it's organic with me. It's just who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose I'll do this till I die.
Well, most people accept the medical procedures. They take it for granted. You were indicating that a little earlier about the right to have an abortion if one chose. And so you can't imagine like a tonsillectomy being abolished. The people that are activists in the pro-choice movement are generally, and this is, I should say, published by the Feminist Press at the City of New York. It's feministpress.org. And I'm going to lose my question here in a second. The book is Intimate Wars, and you can go to intimatewars.com. There'll also be a link on my website, peterwerby.com. The pro-choice movement, although there's been demonstrations of a million people, the activists seem to be centered in a white middle-class feminist milieu, which Gaia love you all, and me too. I've been at some of those demonstrations. However, the people that probably in a way need it the most, poor women, working class women, women
right.
of color, they're not as involved as the main constituency of feminism. Question you're wondering? I don't know.
It's a very important issue, and it's. Let me start with what politicized me, which was Henry Hyde cutting off Medicaid funds for poor women in 1976. Now, for abortions, Medicaid, and his statement was, if I can't save all the babies, I can at least save the babies of the poor.
Huh.
So he takes away abortion rights from the people and the women who need it the most. Now, these were black women, minority women, young women, and I was so amazed and so incensed that I just created some pamphlets, started to walk down the halls of Queens College, which was my alma mater, and knocked on the doors of the professors, asked to speak, and went in and said, "My name is Merle Hoffman, and I'm here to tell you about a tremendous threat to women's reproductive freedom and women's lives." And I proceeded to tell them about the Hyde Amendment. The reaction is, well, oh, well, we can go to Philadelphia, we can go to Puerto Rico or London. Those were the places at the time you went, if abortion becomes legal. There was no, again, that empathic connection. There was no understanding. Once they take it away from the first group of people, then you're next. So my feeling was that there was always the problem that in 1976 there should have been the biggest march on Washington demanding the overturn of the Hyde Amendment. That didn't happen. So, yes, there's been a bifurcation of black women and white women in terms of working together. We've always tried to work in coalition. I actually am working very closely with a woman named Loretta Ross, who founded Sister Song. And there is a group of very, very powerful, articulate black women, pro-choice warriors, who are talking about reproductive rights in terms of reproductive justice. They want to expand the concept. It's not enough just to say we want the right to terminate our pregnancies. We also want the right to have our children. We want the right to equal prenatal care. We want the right to equal women's health care. All of the things that so many middle-class people take for granted that poor minority women don't have. So, Peter, you bring up a very important, interesting, and critical point that we are in the pro-choice movement now starting to expand our discussions, especially with the cuts in health care and insurance, to talk about reproductive justice.
Let's do that. You know, I'm looking at the clock. We have about 5 minutes left with Merle Hoffman and in her just published book, Intimate Wars, published by the Feminist Press. And I don't want to end on a negative note, but the violent men of the anti-choice movement that have gone so far as to murder people, even
right.
Any sense what drives these people? I mean, it's got to be, you know, they say they're protecting the babies. It doesn't
yes.
wash with me. What do you think?
Well, yes, I do. You see, after 40 years and after so much debate and so much thought and so much work in this issue, I do understand them. And they have a radically different worldview. I mean, you have to put on a totally different set of glasses to understand the cognitive differences in how they think. And they truly believe that women who are having abortions are the same as Hitler and Goebbels, who are taking Jews into the gas chamber. Those are the analogies they use. And because they believe deeply that these are babies that are being killed in there, they will do anything to stop it. And they see it as a higher moral calling. And, you know, they've even said things like, well, I mean, if you had the chance to kill Hitler or to kill Rommel, would you do it? You know, so this is the thinking. I mean, they will put their lives on the line. They will, some of them, not all of them, will kill others. I mean, the radical fanatics. But a lot of their language leads to this kind of thinking also. It reinforces this. You know,
well,
these are baby killers, abortoriums, I mean, all sorts of things. We have to be able, women have to be able to say, I had an abortion, and say it without apology. You know, be able to finally own that decision. Morally, legally, in terms of their consciousness, and not be made to feel so ashamed.
And you, Merle Hoffman, you've had an abortion, and now you're a mother.
Yes.
Now you're a mother.
Also. Yeah, oh, yes. I late in life, I decided to adopt a daughter, and it was, I think, the best thing that I ever did. I love being a mother. And you know why I love it so much? Because it was my time. Because I could do it, because I could give my daughter the attention that I wanted to and the way I wanted to live as a mother. When I had my abortion, I could not do that. So, yes, I had one.
Yeah, you know, oftentimes, too, and again, I don't want to end on negative stuff, but women say, well, like the woman, all of a sudden she's out of my mind, her name, the Roe v. Wade.
Yeah, right.
She
right.
says, oh, you know, I never should have done it. My baby would be 41 now or something like that.
She wasn't even pregnant during that decision, you know? I mean, that wasn't even an issue at that time. But, yeah, Jane McCorvey, she really did she had an epiphany, and she developed the fact that, oh, you know, she saw the light. Jesus, I think, came into her while she was in the bathroom one day, or Flip Benham, I think, baptized her in a tub. And this is true, I'm not being sarcastic, and she saw the light, and she turned, and she became a very, very effective anti-choice spokesperson.
Well, let's do this. We have about a minute left with Merle Hoffman, your women's health clinic, the choices, and so much is at stake, so much is on the line right now. What's next? What's necessary politically?
Well, there's a lot necessary. We have to draw a line in the sand and stop all of these legislative attempts to overturn every part of Roe. We have to hold the elected officials who protest that they are pro-choice and support reproductive freedom, hold their feet to the fire. And women, each woman who has experienced this in her life personally or with a friend, has to be able to own it and to be able to say, yes, I had an abortion, and I'm not apologetic about it. Now, you may be sorry, and I want to very strongly say that the right to choose doesn't mean you have the right to make the right choice. I mean, you can have the right to make the wrong choice, so it could be the wrong choice, but you had that ability, and that should be kept very, very strongly.
Well, thank you so much, Merle Hoffman. The book is Intimate Wars, The Life and Times of the Woman Who Brought Abortion from the Back Alley to the Boardroom. It's published by the Feminist Press at the City University of New York. You can go to feministpress.org, but for directly going to the book, it's intimatewars.com. If you're driving and missing all that, you know, you can go to my website always for a link as well. It's Peter Werbe, werbe.com. Merle Hoffman, thanks so much for being on the broadcast.
Okay, thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.